Right, shall we bow our heads? Thank you. Good morning, honorable members. I'd like to acknowledge the presence of Mr. Harris Kosatu, the presence of Consulting Engineers South Africa. All right, yes, led by CEO Mr. Christopher Campbell. Am I right? Yeah, thank you very much. And the, yes, the entire CESA team, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, CESA. Okay, team. I'd also like to acknowledge the presence of Advocate Jenkins, who is attached to Parliament and is always there to assist us to interpret the law correctly and advise us to take decisions that would fall within the parameters of the law. Well, I would also like to acknowledge the there's a written submission that we received. I see the bishop is not here. It's a submission of the South African Religious Forum, submitted by Bishop Mbegwa. And I must say that we really appreciate your presence. I would also like to acknowledge the presence of Dr. Fletcher from National Treasury. From National Treasury. I would like to also acknowledge the presence of the hardworking staff. And indeed, thank you for preparing for this meeting, and I would like to thank all of you for coming and for your response to our invitation to come into a presentation on this public hearing platform. You are all very welcome. Well, I wish to indicate that today is a very important day to the members of the Standing Committee on Appropriation. It is a day where we will be receiving submissions and inputs from the stakeholders that responded to our invite to come and brief us on this public hearing on the 2018 appropriation bill. As we are all aware, the Constitution makes provision with regard to public participation, and you will find this in your Section 59, 72, and 118. The intention of public participation provisions in the Constitution are clear: to influence government policy outcomes, so that they reflect the will of the people. Therefore, a vibrant civil society and citizenry plays an indispensable role in a democracy. So Parliament provides a national forum for the public consideration of issues and facilitates the involvement of the public in the legislative process. So your inputs and efforts are most valued and appreciated. With these few words, I would like to further ask you to feel free. Let's make this meeting our meeting and achieve all the objective of the meeting. And let's engage and have a free, open, and robust discussion. I thank you. We will then move to item number two, which is apologies. Oh, sorry, I must also acknowledge the presence of PBO, Parliamentary Budget Office. You know, sometimes I think they come from the same office. They need to, without them, promise you, we will not be effective and efficient in our work. So you are welcome. And thank you so much for assisting us all the time. All right. Apologies.
Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members and guests. We only received one apology. It's from Ms. Manana, who is attending to a family matter. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable members, do you accept the apology? Apology accepted. Thank you very much. We will then move on to item number 3, presentation by Mr. G. Harris. You may proceed, sir. What would make you feel comfortable? Please do. Yeah, I do want you to be comfortable.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I very much appreciate the opportunity to present to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I very much appreciate the opportunity to present to the committee, and I'm not going to, I've submitted quite a comprehensive document which I'm not going to read, so I'm going to focus on a couple of high impact items, the critical areas. I think also I very much value the fact that you mentioned the word engagement in your introduction, and I hope that I'm very happy to take engagement during the presentation, obviously through yourself, Chair, or when we have questions and answers at the end. So I think the Minister in the budget speech, which gave rise to the appropriations bill, said that more needs to be done. What he failed to say was to say that more needs to be done with less, and so therefore we need to focus on the high return areas. I'm not going to go through the outline. So let me go to the introductory comments and to focus on, obviously, one of the major reasons why we haven't been re-rated back to the position that we were in is the low economic growth. We do have some indication that it will go up. Some people are saying 2.5%, 3%, but we really need to get it up to 5% or more. And I believe that that economic growth is going to come from small and medium enterprise, and in the short term, and also investments in education. And the timing of investments in education is very important. We've seen the rather robust engagement with the tertiary students in the Fees Must Fall campaign, but as a result, a lot of the money has been soaked up there, and there's nothing left for those people who are starting out in their education. I think we need greater innovation and bolder leadership, and that can rightfully come from this committee. I'm not going to deal a lot on the ratings because that's more a treasury and finance aspect, and I did raise it at that presentation straight after the budget. In terms of transforming for inclusive growth, the South African economy can be likened to a wine glass, where the bowl of the wine glass is large corporates, large government, and large labor. No offense to my colleagues from labor. I believe that I was in big business, so I've been part of that, and I believe that a very good relationship between business and labor, and I've spent enough time in NEDLAC to know the importance of government and civil society as well. But that wine glass is so top heavy that it's unstable, it's teetering, it has a very thin SME stem, and it's very difficult for SMEs to grow into the bowl of the wine glass. And for the 70% of South African households that live on less than 6,000 rand a month, that's household, so that's 20 to 30 rand per person per day, they are caught in the base of the wine glass and can't get into the stem. And we need to transform this into a much more robust tumbler. The concentrated bowl needs to be transformed to be more competitive through supply chain inclusion, and not big corporates just giving out contracts for catering, gardening, cleaning, and travel, but actually integrating into the supply chain and integrating into global supply chains. We need a much, much stronger SME stem, and you'll see in that slide I've got SME and capital SME, which is small and medium enterprises. Having attended the Department of Small Business Development budget both yesterday and the House, there seems to be too much focus on what I call the lowercase SMEs, survivalist and micro entrepreneurs. They're very important to the base of the wine glass, but they actually are not going to be creating the number of jobs. So we need an expanded and stronger SME stem, and then we need to have ways in which people can get out of poverty through jobs and entrepreneurship rather than poverty alleviation initiatives such as grants and expanded public works programs. I don't believe that EPWP is a job creation program. It's a poverty alleviation program. Education is a key driver for reducing inequality sustainably. There's a direct correlation between earnings and education. But it needs a much stronger early childhood development base, and that was highlighted by the President in the State of the Nation's address. And it needs a base that is well-funded and has clarity. I was recently in my local newspaper reading an article on homeless people, and I see that it's the same department in the municipality that deals with homeless people that deals with early childhood development. And I believe that maybe if we had more emphasis on early childhood development, we'd have fewer homeless people. As I say, the job creation has got to come through entry-level upskillable jobs in the medium sector. I was privileged to work for 20 years for a company that 70 years ago was a startup and 50 years ago was a medium-sized enterprise. And there were many people who joined that company, including second-generation employees, who started off as a fettler. For those of you who don't know welding, it's people who clean up behind a fettler and ended up through upskilling themselves with obviously support from the company into coated welders. And that's what I talk about, an entry-level upskillable job. I'm not going to go into the funding aspects because this is the appropriation, so this is the how the money is spent committee. I'm also going to focus and move on to the early childhood development. There are three dichotomies. We can't afford early childhood development as too much money is wasted on tertiary dropout and high school repeats. If we look at the number of times people have to repeat a class, you can trace that back to a lack of early childhood development, a lack of comprehension, a lack of motor skills, etc., etc. And I'm also putting my money where my mouth is, and I'm working with a group of early childhood development centers in Lavender Hill. And it's very humbling to go to those centers and to see. To me, the important thing is not so much the hardware, the building, because a lot of them are in relatively informal structures, or even the warmware, the software, the tools that they're using. The differentiator is the warmware and the teachers, the motivated teachers, most of whom are paid very, very poorly. We also say we can't afford early childhood development because we need to spend money on prisons. And a lot of people in prisons, and I'm not condoning crime, but a lot of them are necessity-based crimes rather than greed or aggressive crimes. And also, we say we can't afford ECD because we're dealing too much in poverty, fetal alcohol syndrome, drug abuse, et cetera, which all contribute to learning difficulties. So if we look at the 490 in the appropriation bills, the 490 million rand that is allocated to early childhood development, and compare that to the 22.7 billion that's allocated to the Department of Basic Education, and the 73 million that's allocated to the Department of Higher Education and Training, we can see where the problem lies. The problem lies is that we have to spend far more than we need to on basic education and far, far more on department on higher education because of a lack of early childhood development. If we look at the money that's focused or paid to budgeted by higher education and training, and I got the tail end of their budget vote yesterday as well, 38.6 billion is spent on universities, and only 10.7 billion on TVET colleges. and I should disclose an interest. I'm vice chair of a TVET college in Cape Town, Northlink College, and I believe that it's those hard skills that are needed not only by entrepreneurs but also by businesses who are great. But if we don't have the reading and the comprehension and we rely on rote learning, we end up in the situation that we've got at the moment, where of the 1.2 million children who start in grade one, and I've got my eldest granddaughter starting in grade one next year, so I also have a vested interest in that, only 4% of those will get more than 50% in maths 12 years later. Now, I'm not saying everybody in the country needs to be an engineer or an accountant or an actuary, but you do need a very good understanding of mathematics. And again, that's where it's important. So my plea is really to in the appropriations, to divert money to early childhood development and to clarify where the responsibility for that lies. To my mind, it's probably with basic education rather than with municipalities or local government, because local government is looking more at infrastructure, and so we see where local government is involved in early childhood development, they tend to focus more on the hardware rather than the software and the warmware. Most brain development occurs prior to age six. As I said, my eldest granddaughter turns age six next month, and it's amazing to see how she has developed. We need to capacitate those early childhood development centres, as I'm doing in a very, very small way in Lavender Hill. We need to find ways in which we can reduce substance abuse, have increased father involvement, and I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm speaking as a male, reduce teenage pregnancies, and increase household-level food security. You cannot learn on an empty stomach or a stomach filled with sugary drinks and fluffy chips. We need to have ways in which people can catch up, so those people who are not in employment, education, or training can go to community colleges and bridge their learning gaps that are a legacy of either bunch of education or failed education in the last 24 years. So we mustn't do early childhood dumping and dormitory. We must move to early childhood development. Moving on to the job creation, and I mentioned yesterday about the budget vote from DBOP and the small business development. If we look at the economic role players, government is not going to be able to create jobs because it already exceeds the norm in terms of spending on wages. EPWP, as I said earlier, is poverty alleviation. Survivalist Me Too entrepreneurs, I've got very low multipliers and are mainly rotating jobs rather than creating new jobs. Lifestyle entrepreneurs are usually very small, five employees or so. Tenderpreneurs do not create jobs. And tragically, we've got a very public example of that through the accounting firm of Nkonki, who was over-reliant on work from the Auditor General. And we need sustainable businesses. The small startup businesses have a high failure rate. Big business is downsizing, as my comrade from COSATU will attest to. So that leaves medium-sized business, and particularly those that have gone over the growth, the start hurdle, and are growing from accelerating from 10 to 50 employees, or scaling from 50 to 500 employees. That's going to be the engine room for job growth in the economy. If we look at some of the initiatives that have been announced to date, both on balance sheet and off balance sheet, the CEO initiative of $1.5 billion, we know why government couldn't put in their matching grant, which would have been indicated, but I think government can match that via no-cost deregulation steps. If they take $3 billion out of the cost of regulation, it would be very, very beneficial across the whole of the startup and small business phase. The focus if we look at the ways in which people start a business, they try and keep their funding lean, they self-fund it, at times use their pension, which they shouldn't be, then they use family, friends, and fools funding, and then they go to angels. But we don't have a culture of angel investing in South Africa, except perhaps in the Muslim, Jewish, and Stellenbosch Africana community, and that last one has taken a big knock recently. So as a result, given the lack of true venture capital, you then have to wait until you can get private equity, which normally starts at 100 million rand because the private equity funder wants to do a 1 million rand due diligence. So an under-resourced entrepreneur would probably cap out in terms of lean self, family, friends, and fools at somewhere between 10,000 rand and 100,000 rand. And a well-resourced community entrepreneur would peak at somewhere between 100,000 rand and maybe 10 million rand, which is very, very far short of the 100 million. So we need to have more money that is put into more incentives for angels and true venture capital. The incentives, we also need to take away the disincentives to grow. At the moment, if my business is less than 50 employees, I get certain enterprise and supply development and BE preferences. The day I'm 50 million and 1 rand, I lose that, or my funder loses that, so they drop me. So we should say, what are we going to do to grow those businesses from 50 million rand to 500 million rand type businesses? Also, 30-day payment periods are not observed by government and also not by big business. We also need to make it large-scale deregulation to make it easier to start and grow and become high employment creators. So the Department of Small Business, 1.5 billion rand budget and the appropriations bill, very little of that goes to medium-sized job creation. And even the Gazelles program is mainly focused on very small or relatively small businesses. I'm not going to talk about the funding side, which is the commercialization. I'm going to move on to the re-regulation. So we need to dramatically simplify tax registration and compliance, and also make entrepreneurship visas far more accessible, because a lot of the skills are lacking as a result of the education system, and as I said earlier, the early childhood development education system. And so we need some help in terms of innovative. A lot of work is being done in innovative startups, but we need that critical mass, and we need it in a lot of areas in South Africa, not just in Cape Town and Johannesburg. So in summary, what am I saying? I'm saying education is the key driver of reducing inequality, and early childhood development is the base and needs even more support. So I've used the hashtag fees must rise to fund early childhood development. And job creation is most likely by the medium-sized businesses. And if we don't get job creation, we're going to have that Arab Spring. But if the jobs are entry-level upskillable and they start impacting or reducing poverty or giving people pathways out of poverty, it will build the hope for the South Africa that the President outlined in his State of the Nation address. Chair, I'd like to pause there and see if there are any questions or comments. And as I say, referring back, Chair, to your introductory point, you talked about engagement, and I would really love if there is engagement, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harris. Thank you for your presentation, very interesting. Honourable members, I saw you were listening carefully. I'm now going to open for interaction with this presentation. All right. I just want to check, Doctor, do you want to come in first or a little later? Because okay, but your hand was up first. Okay, let me allow you and then allow members.
Chair, I just wanted to really support the point around ECD. You made very, very clearly here. And in fact, I think was one of the greatest, in a sense, dilemmas of this budget, from the Treasury side.
Could you please open your mic so that we can...
Okay. Chairperson, I was wanting to, in a sense, support the strong call for ECD and to just also explain that this was a quite a strong dilemma from the Treasury side within this budget. Whereas, of course, a lot of money went into this budget, into higher education. The differential between funding a higher education student and an ECD student has now become quite vast. So the average cost of a subsidy of a tertiary education student is heading up towards $100,000 a student, whereas the average subsidy to an ECD student is around $2,500. So there's about a 25-fold differential between an ECD student and a tertiary education student. The current government funding to ECD, and Mr. Harris, the main funding is actually by the Department of Social Development, which funds most of the pre-grade R ECD, is just under 3 billion rand. And there's been a lot of progress on the costing models by Elifa Labantwana, HSRC, Department of Social Development and others. The costing model suggests as a country we need to spend probably at least 30 billion of public subsidy a year for ECD. And as the speaker points out, we have under a million children subsidized, around 700,000 children subsidized, and we should have around 3 or 4 million children subsidized. So I think, Chairperson, just from the Treasury side, I think we acknowledge that in a sense ECD has perhaps not received as much prominence as we would have liked in this budget, and there has been a big focus in Cabinet also around the ECD strategy. There's an national ECD plan, but it is largely unfunded at present. It's the resources are relatively low towards it, and it's something that, Chair, in the next 5 or so budgets, it's something that really as government, I think jointly we should be trying to give these opportunities to the youngest. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The Honourable Member McLaughlin, and who else wants to speak on this presentation? Honourable Member Gwabaza. Okay, in that order.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I also want to add my voice to the call for ECD. I'm sad to say the condition of the situation is worse than just a financial one. In my experience, what tends to happen is if you get an area, particularly an informal settlement type area, where a lot of the adult population goes off to work in the day, and the children are more or less left to their own devices. And what happens is then there might be a caring mother or two in the area who tends to take them on and has a sort of informal preschool. And then the municipality gets involved and says, no, this is all illegal, you can't do it because you're not complying with all the regulations, and they want to try and shut them down. And then that's where our first major hiccup, because the municipalities are trying to enforce their own regulations because that's what they're there for, but it's not assisting the problem because the problem remains. You can't stop the adults going to work and you can't stop the children from being left at home. So if you disallow these informal preschools, you create an even bigger problem because now there's no care for the children. So you would rather want to encourage that, but to get the municipalities to try and slack off on their rules and assist these people to get to the compliance level, which is sometimes quite a big thing because you've got to comply with all the health and hygiene regulations, and they don't have the resources for that. So they need money for that kind of thing as well. It's not just for a per child kind of subsidy, it's also to get the whole structure right so that children can receive the early childhood development that they need. And then that is distinctly in two sections, and one is very definitely nutrition, because as Mr. Harris rightly says, with no proper fluid in the stomach, the child doesn't develop. It's been proved over and over again. I mean, there's huge stats on it and how effective proper nutrition is. So I think National Treasury really needs to look at how we get around this whole problem, because it's a wider problem than just throwing some money at it. It's a more of an institutional kind of problem at municipal level. Thank you, ma'am.
Honourable Member McLaughlin. Honourable Member Gwabaza.
I Thank you, Chairperson. I sometimes forget this thing because it's not available in my rural village, Chairperson. Yes. I wanted to go to slide 5. That second last bullet. You make a comment about downsizing and automation by big business, and which often results to job losses. Somebody made a suggestion, and perhaps COSATU could comment on this as well. Somebody made a suggestion that if businesses do these things, especially bringing in machines, employers should then consider adding some of their profits arising from automation to workers' salaries to improve the working conditions of, especially to improve the wages of workers. I would be interested to know what would be your initial thinking around that suggestion, because it sounded to me quite sensible. But I was also asking myself, would perhaps such proceeds not go to the to the displaced or retrenched workers, because these machines would have replaced them by way of you know, assisting them financially. So it's either way, it could add to the wages that of the workers that remain employed. It could be shared with those that have been laid off. So there's that kind of thing. Secondly, on page 7, the top slide, that bullet. There's been some thinking in at least two of Parliament's committees around recapitalization, particularly of SAA. There is an emerging thinking which says, I know that Transport is talking about this issue as well, the Portfolio Committee. Don't bail out SAA, fully recapitalize, and then allow it to work in a sustainable manner, because this bailing out is not helping. It simply assists them to run for a couple of months, and then they come back to ask for another bailout. What's your thinking on that? SAA in particular. I agree fully with the other SOEs that have problems. ESCOM is in the same situation, continuously asking for a couple of billions bailout. Couple of months or a year later, they come back to want the same thing. So bailout versus full recapitalization, and then monitoring of how they begin to stand on their own and be sustainable. The ECD and this is my last chairperson. Very interesting comment, important comment that Mr. Harris is making about that. I recall that last year, this committee raised a question about what is it that is driving higher education costs so high. The same comment is being made here now, comparison, for instance, from National Treasury, to the extent that certain sections of the education sector must suffer because in terms of being resourced, suffer because a lot of money must be poured into higher education. I understand the rationale which says assist those students whose household incomes are less than 350,000 rand. That's understandable. But alongside that, there is an almost annual increase of university fees by universities themselves, and there is no clear explanation about, and the increases are quite high, way above inflation. The question is, what is it that is driving higher education costs so high that higher education is becoming increasingly unaccessible? Thank you.
Honourable Member Snukwanyane.
No, thank you very much, Honourable Chair. I do want to also speak on the issue of ECD first. Excuse me. Just on the slide where you said we cannot afford ECD because of this and that, and you mentioned the issue of wasting money on tertiary dropouts and high school repeats, which is quite true. We have a lot of that. And I think we've got other factors as well in addition to what my colleagues are raising. You know, the issue of school infrastructure. I've got living examples of schools that want to implement ECD, but they just don't have the space. I have an instance in the constituency to which I'm deployed where they've had to go and look for accommodation elsewhere so that they can just house temporarily the ECD. So we do have a whole lot of challenges, and then perhaps what Honourable McLaughlin was saying, like that we've got those at informal settlements. Now, at the informal settlements, we do have a lot of people doing them, but at the end of the day, you ask yourself, is that really ECD? Because you find that sometimes poor people have to take, they are also struggling themselves to actually run those ECD centers, and sometimes they don't even have enough food to feed them. And parents have to pay something for their kids, but at the end of the day, the kids are being looked after. At least they are not left alone, like he was saying, that parents have to go to work and all that, but there's no one looking after them. So I'm just adding that you know, there are so many factors around this issue of ECD, and I agree 100% that ECD is one of the most critical things. And in terms of the tertiary education, obviously we are very happy that poor students are being assisted. But experience has also shown us that a lot of students at tertiary institutions are not taking their education seriously. They drop out, like you have said, but I would imagine, you know, in my head, I'm just imagining that when they're given this financial assistance, there should be a rider to say, if you get this assistance, this is what is expected. Otherwise, recently we had a presentation here on a study done where some of them go on, and some of them have been given this assistance for many, many years, and for some reason they've been given repeatedly, so that they must know that there's a limit. I really don't have the details of how they're implementing it, but I think we should look at a way of saying so many years and not more, or according to the course that the person is doing. Otherwise, we'll have a situation where it goes completely out of control. Thank you.
Thank you. If I may also ask one or two questions. Mr. Harris, you state that all power stations near end of life, where the state can set the rules and private sector can sweat the asset and extend the useful lives through innovation and focused management. Would you like to, please, if you could elaborate on this a bit, to give us even more insight on your thinking? And also, I would like you to expand on the proposed Small Business and Innovation Fund, which will be focused on providing support for entrepreneurs and refined businesses in their startup phases. If you could expand on that one, so to give us a deeper insight also on this. And then, research indicates that out of around 22,000 cooperatives that were registered, only 2,644 are still running. By implication, it means 88% of the cooperatives have closed down or are not operational. What's your take on this? And how do you think we can improve, government can improve on this one, or a turnaround on this? Because to me, you need the co-ops to assist in economic development, inclusive economic development. So if they register but die somewhere along the line, we then need to advise or make recommendations to government on how best they can retain and maintain them, so that we can achieve on this inclusive economic growth. I think there's one more. All right. I know that in your presentation you also have remarked about government and big business not paying your small and medium enterprises, SMMEs, within 30 days. And the implication thereof is that we're not assisting these business entities to assist us with economic growth. So would you elaborate more on big business not paying within 30 days? And what do you think can be done to stimulate or to change this behavior, so that everybody acts in the best interest of the economy of this country and subsequently the best interest of the development of the country? We will then hand over to you to respond. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the input. I did make some notes, and I'm going to try and make sure that I deal with all of the points that were raised. With regards to the representative from the Treasury, I'm really interested that it was debated and discussed at Treasury. I had the privilege once to sit next to Minister Nene at a dinner and was engaging with him about his personal involvement in early childhood development. And I'd be interested in doing a survey of cabinet ministers' involvement in early childhood development, and I think you would find it's quite high, because a lot of them either have children or have got to my stage where they got grandchildren. I do worry about the time that it's going to take over the next 4 to 5 years. I was hoping you were going to say the next 3 to 4 months rather than 4 to 5 years, because my youngest grandchild is 2, and so she needs it now. No, I'm joking. I'm not being there. I'm aware that the money goes through Department of Social Development nationally and at provincial. I'm not aware how that actually gets down to the city, which is an unfunded mandate. I found that figure of 2,500 for ECD versus tertiary of 100,000, and I wasn't sure where the 3 billion, because when I went through the appropriation bill, the amount that went to social development for ECD, I found a figure of 490,800,000 rand, but I'm sure I maybe missed it somewhere. I think you're right that it should be 30 billion, and I would like the opportunity to engage with you. I'm afraid when it comes to ECD, I'm sort of QBE qualified by experience, less so with my own kids because I was too busy building my career, and more so with my grandkids. But I am working, as I said, with that grouping in Lavender Hill and the Centre for Early Childhood Development. And we're working with other civil society organizations as well. So I would like the opportunity to engage, and when I leave, I'll come past you and hopefully get a card so we can continue the engagement. With regards to the first member who raised the question about it's not just funding, it's also quality, I agree, and I made mention of the hardware, software, warmware. And to me, the critical one is the warmware, is the teacher. And if we're going to spend money, we should be capacitating the early childhood development teacher, because those are the people who are molding the next generation of youth that's coming through. There are simple things. I mean, I'm involved with a children's hospital, and I'm saying, why can't we make sure that when every person goes back into a poorly or under-resourced community, they take back what I call a gogo in a box, okay? Just some basic warmware, some basic software. It doesn't have to be sophisticated Lego or things like that. It can just be different colored bottle tops, the kind of things, and I'm sure that we can, through recycling and that, come up with that. I agree with you about adults working and the children at home and no care, and that's why I talk about early childhood dumping or dormitory, which is not happening. The group, and I would be very happy to have any of the members come and visit Lavender Hill, and I can show you the chart of the 90 or so schools that we've got and how each of them are progressing through those various requirements of the municipality to make sure that they are on a proper footing. It's in terms of nutrition, I recently come across, because a lot of these are in areas where there's not a lot of land, but you can get a lot done through vertical farm gardens or vertical food gardens. And we need to make sure that all of our community areas are being used to grow food. All the pavements, all the roofs of the shopping centres and the formal businesses and things like that. And it takes me back to the saying that it takes a village to raise a child. And I think it's important that we do that. I would be happy if it's going to be of interest to share that Gantt chart, taking out the names of the schools and just giving you an indication as to what the kinds of requirements are. And I'm sure that the person involved in Learning and Reach would welcome the opportunity to engage directly with Treasury as well. With regards to the question of big business and job losses and work security, that's actually where I found that the trade unions and myself as a representative of management actually had the common ground, because it wasn't that I was going to lose my job if Bell went under, or the shop floor people were going to lose their jobs. We were all going to lose together. So we actually had a very, very good working relationship is an understanding. I think mechanization is going to happen, and especially as we move towards Industry 4.0. I've got a very small involvement in the forestry industry, and I was amazed to see a video coming out of Canada, shown in Brazil, around forestry 4.0. I thought that would still be one of the old traditional industries, but it's amazing what is going to happen there. In terms of upskilling, particularly your hard labor-intensive areas, your metal workers, your mine workers, which is, you're not going to be able to upskill those people into call center operators or tour guides or things like that. We've got to find ways in which we can help while they're still employed to upskill, so that if their job does become redundant, they have an alternative. They've got a plan B. The recapitalization of state-owned enterprises, honourable member, I'm going to deal with under the other question, but I think it's common knowledge that all the state-owned enterprises are undercapitalized. And I don't have a lot of knowledge of SAA, and I'm going to concentrate a little bit more on ESCOM, where I do have a little bit more knowledge and can make some comments on that. With regards to the can't afford ECD because of the high school repeats and the dropouts, honourable member, I'm afraid I was one of those dropouts, and my mother, because I was effectively raised by a single parent, had a tough love approach, and I actually went and funded the rest of my education. And I think that it is possible at a tertiary level to self-fund education. I see a lot of people who are doing that or are supplementing their education, and it's not something that is given on a plate, and I think we need to prioritize those areas of study that are going to have the greatest economic contribution as well. And then, Chair, with your question about the old power stations, I think ESCOM is focused very much on bringing the new power stations on, and so there's not a lot of focus on the older power stations. We know that ESCOM has gone for very high tariff increases. Up until when I last looked at it, ESCOM has continued to make a profit. So those tariff increases has resulted in tax going to our colleagues at Treasury, which is important, or via SARS to Treasury, and it is important. But it means that 45% of that tariff increase goes off in tax. So that's why I say it's a very expensive way of doing it. I think that if we could sell off some of the old assets and allow people who've got skills at sweating those assets to see if they can extend the life, etc., it would be very good. The small business and innovation. I believe, and I'm not saying this behind his back, I've said this to the CEO at the Technology Innovation Agency, that they should be the Technology Commercialization Agency. I've got a view that South Africa has an innovation surplus and an entrepreneurship or commercialization deficit, and I can go into that on another discussion if you want. Of the co-ops, I believe that it should be not only our focus should not be only on cooperatives, but all people who have got beneficiaries of government incentives. Have we got the return? So it's not just the establishment of the co-op. If we spend R1 million on establishing the co-op, and 5 years later we've got to spend R1 million again on establishing another cooperative, it's not going to be worth. I think the inclusive economic development, in my mind, comes through entry-level upskillable job where you can be a master of your own destiny. With regards to the 30-day factoring, and I think I might lose an ally in Treasury by the statement that I'm saying, is that I believe that if anybody has a valid debt from government or a state-owned enterprise, provincial, municipal, national, they should be able to take that debt to Treasury, and Treasury should pay them, obviously if it's a valid debt, and Treasury should reclaim that money back from the department or entity concerned. And that will give Treasury a much better understanding, far better than the existing DTI non-payment systems. And I believe that any company employing more than 5,000 people should have to make a similar agreement and obligation. So if I'm Anglo-American and I'm not paying my supplier within 30 days, their supplier should know that they can go along to Nedbank or FNB or ABSA or whoever's my designated bank and get that debt factored, but not at the SME's cost, but at the big business's cost. So that will put a lot more emphasis in big business on getting those systems right. I think that hopefully that will come out through one of the economic summits that are coming up, because you know, even a small business, if they're registered for VAT, have to pay the VAT within the 30 days. And we've got some, and I don't particularly want to name them, but you can probably work out who they are, some big businesses that are doing what I call the equivalent of greenwashing in the enterprise and supply development space. So they have these great programs that are helping entrepreneurship development, et cetera, et cetera. But then they put out a tender for some of their own products, and they say that the minimum credit terms is 270 days. So that immediately excludes all of your small and medium businesses, because they haven't got the financial wherewithal to do that. So, and it goes back to legacy issues, the bowl of the wine glass. We need that bowl of the wine glass to be much more competitive. And I know that Competitions Commission and other entities are working at ways in which that can be done. Chair, I'm also very willing to engage. Secretariat has my contact details. I'm very willing to engage bilaterally with any of the members of the committee, and I wish you strength in the work that you're doing, because the prioritizing of the spending of the budget is absolutely critical.
Okay. Honourable members, I know we have time constraint, and if you look, we've got so many presentations. I will allow you to ask a question if you will die if you did not ask. That's how kind I am. I really would like to see that you haven't asked a question. So, yeah, you are fine. Okay. Just one on the SOEs. Very keen, eh? You are saying that recapitalization via revenue is very inefficient.
Yes.
Obviously, you are presenting an angle. So I would like you to just elaborate on that. And then you say SARS is the only winner.
Yes. As I said, I would need to go and explain the difference between debt and equity. And equity is your capitalization. Debt is the loans and the additional funding and the bridging loans that a lot of state-owned enterprises are coming to government for. ESCOM had two ways in which they could recapitalize. They could go to their mother department or an outside entity and say, we want to raise 100 billion rands worth of capital because we're building four new power stations. And I believe that that's what they should have done, because then it's your future consumers who would have been paying for your future energy needs. So at the moment, your current consumers, and I apologize for the use of the word current there, it means current, not an electrical current, but the existing users are paying for the future users' electricity. And so if ESCOM needs to put up its price by 10 cents a megawatt hour, whatever, to cover its costs, but it needs to put it up by 40 cents an hour to cover its current costs plus its future capital costs, once it's, because those future capital costs are all going to flow through to the bottom line, they're going to have to pay tax on it to SARS. Tax on it to SARS. So that's why I say SARS is the only beneficiary, because Eskom continues to make the profit and SARS reaps the reward because they pay the tax to SARS.
I'm not going to leave Treasury out of the book. I really want to just to respond on the matter that he raised, which is of great interest to this committee, because we're also looking for solutions on some of the financial mismanagement, corrective measures, which we will then present to the House as recommendations to the House on a corrective measure. So here, Mr. Harris talks about it's a possible solution, but then I want you to say whether it's feasible or it's not feasible. Treasury pay, if you know, those departments that are owing municipalities, because they are owing municipalities huge monies. Now, we also were looking at a solution of how can we best assist the municipalities to, you know, to get this owed money to them so that they can use that for service delivery. Now, he then is suggesting that Treasury pay and claim the debt from the department. Does the law, does the PFMA allow that, or National Treasury or Treasury regulations allow that? Is this feasible? Because
Chairperson, generally not. I mean, normally if one's to, I mean, effectively, if one's going to go into the department and take over its paying of debt, one's effectively running the department. And that's effectively what the Section 100s are currently in Northwest, for example. You know, at the moment, the OCPO is involved in following up on the 30-day rule, as are the departments, as you've heard from previous reports. But it's very difficult, Chairperson, outside a Section 100 intervention to do that, because it effectively is taking over the role of the accounting officer in terms of the PFMA. On the suggestion, if I can just briefly say on the ECD financing, so the current ECD financing is mainly through the provinces, which is the $3 billion a year. What happened was about 3 or 4 years back, because we recognized that ECD was a big priority, I think we worked with you as a committee to introduce the ECD grant. And the ECD grant is only a small part of the financing of ECD. That's the $480 million or so that the speaker is talking to. Mr. McLaughlin, part of that the ECD grant is in two components. Part of the ECD grant is for the maintenance of the centers. And there's been a bit of a discussion as to what, for example, the size of the fixing projects can be. At the moment, the threshold is up to 20,000. The center is up to 20,000. But some people want to spend up to 2 million to, say, build the center or things like that. So it's a bit of a question for this committee as how you want to see that go. Chair, on the question about the different financing recapitalization options for the SOEs, you know, Mr. Kabaza's point about whether SOE should be SAA should be bailed out and whether ESCOM is deriving through tax, I'm probably not the right person to answer on those questions, Chairperson. I think Ulrika Reda or assets in the liability section would be better place to talk through the details about SOE funding and recapitalization and so on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes the engagement between ourselves.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your presentation and for your responses.
And we will continue to engage.
But also responding to our invitation.
Yes.
Please, let's continue.
Thank you.
Actually,
thank you, Chair.
This engagement begins today. Okay. We must take it into the future.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. I will now call upon presentation by COSATU and If you can introduce yourself, because, you know, we bring stakeholders together because we also want you to know each other so that even after this, you know, after this you can engage outside, you know.
Okay.
It's about nation building.
All right, Anna, thanks very much, Chair. Good morning to members and colleagues. My name is Matthew Parks from the Congress of South African Trade Unions. And I think we just want to thank the Chair members for giving us our chance to share the views of our 1.7 million members of COSATU and their families at large. Chair, look, the written submission we've given is quite detailed. We can't go through all of it because we'll detain you for the whole of this morning. And we've touched on some issues a bit beyond the appropriations bill itself, revenue, economic, climate, etc. But I think what we show members our kind of holistic view as COSATU of where we are, why are we here, and what's the way forward. And of course, these things overlap between each other. They're not things you can just separate completely. I think I'll just try to summarize some of the key issues from our part, Chairperson. I think, Chair, look, as COSATU, we were quite pleased for once in a very long time with the State of the Nation address in February this year, Chair. We felt that really that this vision of a new dawn, it's long overdue, it's very opportune. It might help us to move forward as a nation as we talk, Chair, about nation building, or at least getting our act together as a nation, Chair. We're quite pleased with the President's detailed commitment to the SONA towards the job and investment summits, plans for each sector of the economy to get the economy moving. And of course, it is heartening to hear President speak about how do we absorb the millions of unemployed workers. Because if we don't do that, then everything else we're trying to do will never come right. Chair, I think we've also were quite pleased with the detailed attention the President has given, and even the new Minister of Public Enterprises around the crisis of corruption in the state-owned enterprises in particular. It really is a ticking time bomb, Chair, especially the issue of Eskom. Chair, I think we're pleased with the change in the leadership of the state and that many of the colleagues from Cabinet have been removed. This is something that COSATU has been calling for quite some time, and we think it's a chance to get moving, Chair, to focus on the real issues. Chair, I won't go too much into revenue issue because that's not strictly your baby, but I think, Chair, we must say as COSATU are quite disappointed that the sins of those who have looted the state, be it politicians or, I think Guy has left, what Guy is this nice acronym, Family, Friends and Fools. It's a bit of a harsh acronym, but anyway, we think those, the elite who have stolen from the state, were now passing the bill to workers through a VAT hike, through massive fuel, RAF, sugar drinks, other hikes, and of course through the reduction in the public service employment levels of about 3% in the past few years, the austerity, etc. You can't just spend your way recklessly, but Chair, we really want to see more action be done to those who have looted from the state. We don't see a significant amount of a plan to deal with that issue. We're also worried that, you know, Chair, if you go through the budget of each department in this year's budget, only about 7 departments have specific job creation targets. Yet we have 35 departments, and really every single department, even the smallest department of sports or recreation, should be tasked with job creation. The fact that it's only the economic cluster, water affairs, energy, environmental affairs, which bothered to put some job targets is quite worrying. And some of those job targets are so small, you know, 800 jobs for environmental affairs, when we're sitting with, you know, 6 million, 8 million unemployed. We're not going to deal with the issues if we don't deal with that problem, Chair. Chair, I won't go too much into the revenue issues. I think it's more for members' information's sake. We don't want to give them pressure because we're not just coming with complaints, but we have proposals as well about how to balance the budget, how to increase taxes on the rich who can afford it, and not to squeeze the poor too much. But again, having said that, Chair, we don't think we're going to resolve the revenue crisis until we resolve the crisis at SARS. SARS has been at the epicenter of state corruption and capture. We're pleased that the President has suspended the Commissioner. We're quite disappointed, though, that the previous Minister of Finance in October last year called upon for a commission of inquiry into SARS. That has not happened, and it's about 7 months later. We think the issues of SARS are much deeper than one person. And I think, Chair, the reports you see about organized criminal syndicates involved in the tobacco industry, etc., basically getting their tax bills wiped off at SARS, is very worrying, Chair. It's unfair that public servants, even members of parliament, ordinary people pay their taxes. But you hear reports of the tobacco smugglers and other persons being allowed simply to walk away with a tax holiday. Chair, I won't go too much into our revenue proposals. I think it's just for members' information's sake. Again, we have some proposals around how you can increase taxes from the wealthy, etc. We are worried that, Chair, we are overtaxing workers, and we're getting to the point where it's beginning to suffocate the economy. Having said that, Chair, we do agree that you must have a sustainable approach to the budget. We are worried that in the past few years, the way we've increased the debt levels, the deficit levels, we're heading towards the debt trap. And we've seen from other countries in Africa, even Europe, Greece, Ireland, etc., what happens if you go that route. We'll be very worried if we were to continue down that road. Then we'll see an IMF or World Bank intervention. And if you look at, Chair, if you look at a country like Greece, what happened then is that the government is told not just cut cabinet by half, which would support, but cut public servants' wages by 25%, cut pensions by 25%. In fact, Chair, it got so bad in Greece that Germany was telling the Greek government to even sell some of the islands. We don't have many islands, Chair, but we're worried that if we do that, all the gains since 94 of social grants, social delivery, would be slashed if we went down that route, Chair. Chair, I think, and you know, our figures are not figures that we have some suck, Chair. These are stats from government. The Auditor General talks about 64 billion rand worth of wasteful expenditure. The Hawks quoted a figure of 50 billion rand of stolen assets. I think Komal Pravin talked about 100 billion rand we've lost through state capture. So really, Chair, government has got enough money, but the question is for government to manage itself properly, Chair. We know you can't expect miracles overnight. The President, Pravin, are moving, but it's not enough, Chair. Chair, we think we're not going to make serious progress in law enforcement issues if we remain with the current Director of Public Prosecutions. You know, we can move as a state if we don't get the leadership correctly, Chair. We really want to see government in each department come with plans to solve their own internal issues, because, Chair, today you hardly find a single department without some sort of corruption, state capture, wasteful expenditure crisis. You know, even a small department like Water Affairs, which used to be one of the most respected departments, you know, when Comrade Ricardo was Minister of Water Affairs, it was the prize of government. Today it's collapsed. So we really want to see much more effort by government. We want to see persons not just being redeployed or fired, but being sent to prison. You know, you can't have SAA, the best airline in Africa, today on the verge of complete collapse, almost beyond rehabilitation, yet no one is held accountable. It's very worrying, Chair, the culture we're entrenching here. You know, Paul's Mall is full of prisoners, but we're not finding a single politician there, Chair. We can give a deployment list if you want. Government has done some good work saying, for example, civil servants must not be allowed to do business with the state. But again, it must go much further than that, because often the corporates are councillors. It must go further than that. We were pleased when the President talked about a lifestyle audit, tax declarations. We think they should apply for the entire leadership of the state, be it ministers, be it mayors, MECs, and including the executive of government, DGs, DDGs, especially the parastatal leadership. Chair, we'll encourage the Parliament moving fast to pass the Auditor General Bill, and that the Finance Committee will be passing the PIC Bill. We think those will be useful tools in the fight against corruption. Chair, in our original submission, we made quite a few proposals on how we can reduce wasteful expenditure. We're very happy to see that the President has reduced cabinet very slightly. We think you can reduce it by half, and you can go further than that. We don't need to have 90 MECs. We can have 8 MECs per province. Chair, we really think that the culture of kind of blingy expenditure that politicians seem to love and parastatal love, it can come to an end. You know, it speaks about our mismanaged priorities if our budget for land reform is the same amount as our budget for bodyguards. You know, I think the police have identified 284 persons who deserve bodyguards. So we spend the same protecting those 284 individuals as we're saying for land reform. Yet land reform was a key political issue. It doesn't make sense, Chair. And I'm not sure, Chair, if a Deputy Minister of Sports and Culture really has so many enemies that he needs bodyguards 24/7. So, Chair, really, you think that the bling expenditure, it can be addressed? You know, if you have the situation, Chair, of Eskom pleading for bailouts, yet you see reports that Eskom is spending 150 rand on a water bottle, you know, it means we're not serious as a nation. Again, the culture of unspent budgets, and of course, come January, where departments engage in fiscal dumping to avoid Treasury taking back unspent money. Chair, again, you know, the issue of accountability, how is it that Eskom is a specialist in mismanagement? They're now asking for additional tariff hikes because they've under-collected 66 billion rand. Yet we don't see Eskom leadership being held accountable. They're allowed to resign quietly. Nothing has happened. No one goes to jail. Chair, I think for us, the critical issue, one of the critical issues is the SOEs, and those are really the things which threaten the very survival of the state. You know, if we talk about SAA with 20 billion, 30 billion rand, and how government is having to bail them out year after year, the Eskom crisis, Chair, can collapse the state tomorrow. You know, if your Eskom has a debt of 350 billion rand, that's 20% of the state's budget overall. If that debt is called in tomorrow, we will see mass retrenchments in the public service, we'll see pensions cut. We won't survive. We're not sure that the plans of Eskom will go deep enough to turn the situation around. We are pleased that Colin Pravin is overhauling the SOE board. That's a good step, but it needs to go deeper than that, Chair. I think we really want to see comprehensive forensic audits of the SOEs, Eskom, SAA, Prasat, et cetera, to really get to the depth of the corruption. Chair, we're worried that now the first casualties of the state capturing the SOEs is going to be workers. So Eskom is now talking today about no increases for workers. The Eskom chairperson is talking about reducing Eskom's employment headcount by 3,000 next year and then reducing it later by 30%. So it's about 20,000 jobs. SAA is primarily looking to retrench about 1,000 workers. I think Prasat are also looking at retrenching about 800 workers. We see what happened in Telkom from 94 to date, where it went from about 50,000 employees to about 5,000. So, Chair, really, we're not sure why workers who have not looted are the first ones to pay the price, Chair. Chair, we're worried about the impact of austerity, and we know we can't spend our way recklessly, but it seems the impact is, again, the poor. So we've seen service delivery cuts. Worry about scaling down on infrastructure expenditure, the freezing of critical public service posts. Chair, we're now seeing nurses working 36-hour shifts, doctors working 48-hour shifts. In this year's budget, there's a plan to reduce the police service headcount by about 3,000, yet we see rampant crime levels. There's a plan to reduce the correctional services headcount by about 866 staff members, yet we know the overcrowding crisis in the correctional services. Chair, having said that, you, on the other hand, you see a ballooning of management posts in the public service from about 10 to 20,000. If you check the Sunday papers, the posts you see being advertised is always the SMS posts. It's not nurses. We've seen the impact upon teaching already with our classroom headcount increasing. But, Chair, look, we were willing to engage on this issue and we have some proposals. We know politicians like to complain about the public service wage bill and somehow that it's wrong for nurses to want to be paid a living wage. I think, Chair, we're forgetting to mention how the state had to address the apartheid wage gap within the public sector, where it's about 13 to 1, and how in the private sector it's about 10 times that level. So we really think there's need for attention there. And also, Chair, that your public servants support about 5 to 7 unemployed persons each. So it's not as if they are just greedy or selfish. We think, Chair, that what you can do is two things. One is to engage with the Public Service Bargaining Council about what post vacancies can be left frozen for to stabilize the state. But also, Chair, we think you need to do a headcount of ghost posts. You receive reports in Northwest and Free State and Limpopo, Eastern Cape especially, of thousands of ghost posts. So let's do the cutting of there, first of all, Chair. Chair, into the specific departments, we're quite worried about the Mineral Resources Department. We're pleased that a former mine worker is now in charge of it. We're hoping they'll come with a jobs plan, a beneficiation plan, and a plan to improve health and safety conditions there, which are quite atrocious, Chair. We hope that business will come to the party in that regard. Chair, we also think that the Department of Labour should be given special consideration to be allowed to employ more labour inspectors, otherwise it's very difficult to enforce the labour legislation. Chair, I think you would have seen in the past month or 2 months in the Northwest the extent of the crisis in the state, where you have patients sharing a bed, in the state hospitals where you have a lack of medication, etc. That's partly what has fueled in the hunger strike. Chair, we also see that your community health workers are basically outsourced. They're not public service employees, but they're given this very small wage, yet they're doing public service work. Chair, we have a shortage of about 30,000 nursing posts, yet we don't see an expansion of nursing education opportunities in our colleges or universities. In fact, you see a brain drain. We're nursing the rural areas of Canada and New Zealand by the brain drain from our country. And of course, Chair, you'll see that the crisis in the health department is seeing an explosion in non-communicable diseases like diabetes, obesity, cancer, etc. I think, Chair, you would have seen in Gauteng recently about cancer patients having to wait months for chemotherapy treatment. And this is a life and death issue. Chair, I think I'll be coming towards the end. Chair, I think, look, despite all our grievances against the former president, I think we must commend him for the leadership he gave around the university fees crisis. We must appreciate that. That is a historic achievement. It's not the complete solution, but it's a step in the right direction. It's unfortunate the guy has left, because I'm not sure today with university fees levels any student can fund his way through university by working as a waitress. If you have UCT, for example, the fees is about 60,000 rand.
Which guy left? The gentleman was
Yes, here? Guy Harris.
Remember, he came to talk to us. We released him. He didn't run away from you. We released him because we thought he's done. And then we then invited him to come on board.
I was just pleased that the business called COSAGO Comrades, so we're making progress. Hopefully, we're not selling out of COSAGO. Chair, I think the one thing which frustrates us deeply about the education department was two things, rather. One is the issue of the math schools. You know, I think former President Mbeki talked about 2004, when he said, right, when we would have finally eradicated math schools. Yet we see every year the same stats. I think it's about 246 math schools will finally be dealt with. It can't be like that, Chair. It can't be that we can deliver world-class stadiums. We even had some ministers who are ambitious to expand nuclear power. Yet we can't address a simple thing like putting decent toilets in schools, putting windows in schools, etc. We've seen the overcrowding increase in the schools because of the freezing teaching posts. So we also have teachers in Eastern Cape and Limpopo who've had to go to court to get paid because they are school governing body posts and they're not being paid by the department. And the fact that SADU now is forced to go to court so they can get paid. So I know the Women's League has made a correct call about sanitary pads. And our proposal here is simple. Let the Department of Education expand its program to buy sanitary pads for girl learners, obviously, and just to manage it very tightly to avoid the corruption we've already seen popping up in Northern Cape, in KZN, etc. But it needs to be a correct approach to do it. I won't go into SASA too much, Chair. I think you members would know very much about it. Changes of land reform, we think that really, again, the point that we need to allocate more there and also allocate proper management structures there. Because you see that two-thirds of our land reform projects fail after a few years. It's just we're not doing it correctly. We need to give sufficient support to new farmers and walk with them the whole process. Again, Chair, I think the issue of the sanitary pads, let us look at that also for farm workers as well, who are the most impoverished workers. Chair, I think just the issue of water failure, we think the colleagues in the portfolio committee have done good work about trying to intervene in the department. But really more needs to be done, and I think, Chair, you know, it's not just Cape Town which is in a water crisis, it's the entire country. We're one of the most water-scarce countries in the world, and really we need to see much more effort into the infrastructure maintenance, conservation, recycling, desalination. And you know, Chair, you're in a crisis of Limpopo, which is water-rich, has water shortages at times. But it's a chance also to create jobs, Chair. I think, Chair, look, on the issue of energy, I know it often sounds like COSATU is against renewable energy. Our issue there is not about that. It's about Eskom threatening to close coal plants and not having a plan for those workers to be reskilled and to be absorbed in new jobs. We want to see Eskom itself investing in renewable energy, owning it, and then taking those workers in Witbank and Middelburg, etc., the coal heartland, and making sure they are re-employed in the renewable sector. And of course, Chair, I think we want to see the state intervening in Eskom to stop this thing that passing the bill for looting at Eskom onto consumers. It's really suffocating the industry and the economy. Chair, in terms of transport, it's a complete crisis. You know, we have Cape Town, which is lucky to have Metro Rail. And, you know, workers in Cape Town never get on time to work, and their wages are then deducted. But it takes a worker about 2 hours to get to town on Metro Rail because it's forever in a crisis. And we're lucky to have Metro Rail in Cape Town, not about other areas. We think, Chair, the government really needs to come to a serious public transport plan, and they get a plan to close the E12 issue. Especially for politicians who want to win Gauteng next year, Chair. Chair, I think just one issue around SAPS. And the government did very good work since 94, doubling the employment levels in SAPS. But now we have a weird situation in SAPS where the head office of SAPS has 56,000 employees. Then you have about 120,000 police officers deployed to station levels, but half of that are deployed again to administrative type jobs. So only about a quarter of the police force actually are on the street doing actual crime prevention, crime investigation, etc. So it's a very bizarre situation, Chair. It's very top-heavy. There's a need for serious political intervention. So we can see at least three quarters of the police officers on the street in townships doing door-to-door patrols. Chair, we'd want to see more money being pumped into the labor courts where you have a two-year backlog on average for cases. We are worried about the Border Management Authority in terms of the Customs Authority being transferred to them. And I think, Chair, you're not the Intelligence Committee, but the fact that they have so many scanners emanating from the State Security Agency, you've got a budget of about 4.6 billion rand, and it seems Parliament is far behind in getting to grips with that issue, Chair. And again, we can't be pleading poverty as a state, yet we have some persons in the state who are just looting unashamedly, untouched. Though we are pleased with the President making some initial interventions the past week around the state security. Chair, just in conclusion, I think we've mentioned all those details. We are hopeful that the Presidential Job Summit and Investment Summits will help to get the nation moving forward. We are working closely as COSATU with other labor federations, with business, with government around a jobs plan to cover all sectors to see how to grow the economy, what resources we bring from the state, from the private sector to move the nation forward. That'll be the real solution to the crisis we're in. Yeah, and I think I mentioned some issues there, Chair. I hope I've not gone too long, Chair. But yeah, no, thanks very much for giving us space.
Thank you so much for another interesting presentation. Indeed, it is informative on how you think about this appropriation bill and you actually have also alluded to some improvement areas, the gaps, and made proposal on how government can improve in the allocation of funds to those areas of need. But thank you very much. Honourable members, I will now ask you to reflect and engage with COSATU. Now I call it department. What does it mean? Am I prophesying something? That was on a lighter note. Okay. Honourable members, do you have any question, clarity-seeking question? Oh, okay. Over to you, Honourable Member McLaughlin. Honourable Member Shopestole, pass your hand up. Yes. Maybe number two. And, okay. Number three, Honourable Member Snukwanyane. In that order.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, ever since I've been in this committee, I've been surprised every time COSATU presents to us, because I'm always so surprised about how much I agree with him. And it seems almost politically incorrect, but it's a fact, because so much of what we're presented with is factual, and it's exactly what we should be aiming at. So I welcome what Mr. Park says in the main. I think it's... He picks out some very pertinent issues. I was just comment estate duty and inheritance taxes. You know, estate duty at this point in time doesn't actually contribute much in the bigger picture. It's something we've inherited from the past, excuse the pun, but it doesn't really do much for anybody anyway, and it would probably be something that Treasury could easily scrap. It would probably cost less to incur the administration costs that are involved that actually benefits. So I would have a question mark on that one. Maybe Mr. Lynch would have a different approach to that, but my feeling is it doesn't really bring in much, and it probably is not a cost-effective issue. When we speak of the state-owned enterprises, I share your concerns, Mr. Parks. I think we have a huge looming problem, because I read with some concern yesterday about Treasury had issued a commitment letter, which in effect was to guarantee a guarantee in respect of one of our state-owned enterprises. And I think we're going from the sublime to the ridiculous here, because it's, how do you do that? How do you guarantee a guarantee? If the guarantee itself is not good enough, another piece of paper guaranteeing that guarantee is not going to be any better. And yet this seems to be where we're headed. I just can't understand this. And as you rightly say, sir, if all the lenders, and I think the main lender to the state-owned enterprises is, of course, the our Reserve Bank, if they were to call in the loans, we'd be up the spout, because all these guarantees add up to a huge amount of money. The biggest chunk of our budget almost these days is going to debt servicing costs, and we don't reduce the debt. We manage it in the sense that we keep a cap on the increased rate of borrowing. That's all we do. And I think it's a huge concern that really needs to be turned around. How exactly we're going to turn it around, I can only see as if these enterprises themselves started becoming profitable and started being able to service their own debts and take that load off the state. You mentioned, of course, the wage bill, which, as you rightly say, we do like to make a noise about, but perhaps not in the same sense that you seem to think, because it's my impression that the government has attempted to almost solve the unemployment problem by employing as many people as it possibly can. But that means we employ a lot of people who don't necessarily do a lot of work, and we don't pay them a great deal of money, but we do employ them. And I think it would be far more cost-effective if, as you say, the nurses and those who had skills were paid a far more living wage, and we employed less people who don't do very much, try and sort of consolidate rather than just spread this load across, because while it might be better earning a small salary than earning no salary, we as a state can't afford that. Perhaps that kind of function should be left to the private sector if they want to get involved in there. But as government, I don't think we should be doing that. I think we should be getting value for our money and employing the right people for the right job. And then the wage bill wouldn't be the big problem that it is at the moment. I think that'll do me. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. And thank you, COSATA, for your supporting this committee at all times. We really appreciate it. I agree with COSATA in many things, maybe because I have to. I don't know. because I'm just looking at this thing of ghost posts. Because I think we should be in a position to deal with this thing. I can't understand why after 20 years we're not yet able to deal with this. I think as this committee we should actually write a very strong recommendation on a government to make sure that this is done away with, because this is looting and this is just corruption that can easily be done away with. On the issue of increasing nurses, I think this is very necessary, because at the back of my mind I always say government is not employing too many people because it's women. And they think as women we must always sacrifice, you know, that attitude. And it doesn't sit well in my conscience that we can talk about caring about women and not actually making sure that those few women who actually are skilled are not properly paid. The one that I 100% agree with Kosato is the tax issue. I always say there is one answer: tax the rich. Tax the rich. You can't be taxing the poor, and you when the inflation is going so up, the poor are already struggling. And I don't agree with austerity measures. We don't have any evidence that any country that has applied austerity measures did succeed. The evidence that is there is that all the countries that went into austerity measures ended up with very big debts and high unemployment and extreme inequalities. So I think as a committee we should express ourselves basing our expression on the available evidence. On the issue of consequences for wrongdoing in state-owned enterprises, I really agree with Kosato, but I am worried why Kosato doesn't express itself on the issue of Coleman having sold the fly machines and didn't bring the money back. Because we can say what we like. The problems of SAA was caused by the fact that aeroplanes were sold and money didn't come into the coffers of the SOE. It's a simple accounting principle. For every debit, there must be a credit. You can't sell assets and not replace them, and the money just vanish. I always ask myself, why is Kosato not talking about this one? Because I think I'm not in love with putting people to jail. I want people to pay back the money. That's what I want. Because in jail, they're going to consume our taxes. And I also wonder why Kosato is not so vocal on the issue of the integrated financial management system. Because that happened in Treasury. And for any country, whether democracy or no democracy, a country's reliability is measured on its treasury. If you have the rot of that level right inside treasury, we can talk about anything and maybe the media flower it and color it, but the investors look at the safety of their investment. They look at treasury itself. That is one. Two, all our problems, financial accounting problems in the country, would be better handled if this system was made to work. Because it would make life easy for Treasury to actually assist all the provinces and all the municipalities. But people talk about the consequence and corruption in SOS. They never talk about this. And I ask myself, you know, if we are serious about rooting out corruption in this country, we must not be selective in our criticizing. We must call a spade a spade. Whether it is McGowan or it's Sheila, it's got to be the same yardstick that we measure. I still believe Kosato must talk about the corruption in Treasury very strongly. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Member Snukwanyane.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. And thank you very much, Kosato, for the presentation. The first thing I would like to speak to is the issue of public service employment reduction, which you spoke very strongly about. I know that this is a very sore point, and naturally, as a labor union, you would obviously lead in dealing with it. But just to say that, you know, this issue has been going on for so long. It's been going on, and I mean, it's a reality. It's happening that a lot of posts are not being filled and all that. But also, I just want to check with you if you've got any information on those areas where the structures or the directories or whatever are bloated, because that is one thing that we're hearing, that a number of them, they were posts that were created, perhaps then would shift some of those, because if they were created for people when there was no need, we need to also look at that. The other thing is the issue of debt. I mean, I think my colleagues someone has mentioned the issue of debt, servicing of debt. But one thing that I didn't quite understand was that of avoiding the debt trap of Africa. I don't want to talk about the IMF and World Bank, I understand quite well. But that one of Africa, I didn't quite get what you wanted to say. On the issue of infrastructure, I agree with you. Infrastructure is one of our trump cards for creating, for boosting economy. But now we have this situation of the economy in this country, where some of the things, even no matter how much we need them, but we had to compromise them. And this goes also for veterans. I saw you actually, as one of your proposals, said we need to cancel, do away with VAT. Have you thought about any other proposals? Because we do want the money. We cannot say, let's forget about the social package, for instance, as an example. Have you thought about any other proposal of how we can then raise some revenue? Because we do need to raise the revenue from somewhere. Thank you very much.
Thank you. If I may also ask a question. All right, in your presentation, maybe let me ask you to comment on the statement from the 2017 budget review. In terms of the statement, data published in the 2017 MTBPS showed that over the past decade, compensation has crowded out other areas of spending, particularly in labor-intensive departments. At the same time, cost of living adjustments have exceeded consumer price index inflation by an average of 2% points. Public servants tend to be better paid than most taxpayers in general. I'd like you to comment on that one, because I am aware of government strategy to try and bring down administration costs in favor of service delivery. So must remember, government time and again would have to come up with ways and means of addressing these unlimited demands during this period of the unfinished transformation. So if you can give us your thinking there on how you think, so that we can also take that into consideration in our engagement. Again, all right, we know that government states that it will intensify its efforts to build durable partnerships with the private sector and labor to promote national development. What else do you think needs to be done to strengthen these partnerships? Okay, then
where you are, I know, isn't it, we're engaging with one another. You are then proposing that the VAT hike must be cancelled. In your presentation, you commend the former president for having come up with the fee-free education. And in the entire budget, there was no budget allocation for fee-free education, which then forced government to go back to the drawing board to look at where government can find money. Because in terms of budget principles, you can't use money you don't have. So in its mitigating strategy, government then came up with a 1% hike, which translated to 36 billion. Please correct me if my figures are right or wrong. And also government had to find money again to fund this fee-free education. I don't know if I'll be using the right terminology if I say it's another trade-off in favor of or in support of the fee-free education, and government then embarked on budget cuts to find the 57 billion for the MTF period for the fee-free education project. Now, I do want you to assist us now on what is your take now that you've brought these sets to the fore. Money had to be found somewhere. But also, I promise you, everybody out there is against government further borrowing money. But money had to be found. And some people would say, I know I attended a meeting with some Germans who spoke about, what is this term that they use? It's a spirit of solidarity. So amongst ourselves, we find a way within of where we could make compromises in order to push those key projects that are key to the realization of the NDP or to the development of the country and the development of the economy. So I would want you to then at least, if you could give some clarity on what do you think? Yeah, because it's a matter of finding money to support this progressive move, money which was not there. All right, and then again, you stop. You I think it's page five. Sorry. On page five, under expenditure, I agree with you. Government needs to reduce wasteful expenditure, and you say there must be a plan to reduce those expenditures. But then you further say stop rollover of unspent budgets. Now, the other side of the coin is presently government is sitting with a situation where immediately after adoption of this appropriations bill into or promulgating it into an act, observations are that departments are going to take money from the new allocation for this new financial year and service accruals. And it's a big problem because we are also saying they're using money they don't have, né, to service those accruals. Now, you are saying here they must stop rollovers. But the rollovers, just for information sharing, is rollovers on committed committed spending.
So it's rollovers on committed spending. Now you say they must stop rollover of unspent budgets. And I've told you about this other problem that you're not aware of. And we're sitting with it here. We all are trying to find what could be the best solution. Promise we engaged Treasury. Hey, we even thought it was Treasury's fault. And Treasury put us in our space to say, no, please. To say, no, it's not our fault. Go to the departments. They said, no, what are you doing to stop? Because now we're passing a budget that we know it will not be correctly used. You know? So, yeah. So I thought I should bring this one, and then so that we can then engage. We would then ask you to respond to the issues that were raised by members.
Thanks, Chair. thanks to members for the questions. Let me start in chronological order to Honourable McLaughlin, and I think Chair, it is a special rule in Parliament which doesn't allow the DA to publicly agree with COSATU, because it always gets in trouble afterwards. But then the only thing is also agree with COSATU. Chair, look, I think we put our tax proposal there. Not anyone is a magic wand, but we wanted to say, look, we don't support a VAT hike or the fuel hikes, because they hit the poor the hardest, their fuel inflation, etc. But I wanted to give alternatives. That's why we mentioned quite a few. And when we looked at some of what academics, not just COSATU sloganeers, but academics at universities have come with, they've identified if you increase the company tax, there's quite a significant cut in company tax over the past few years. And the promise was that that will help to create jobs. But if we've seen no creation of jobs, we've seen cuts in jobs. And yes, if we must swallow bitter medicine, well, we think the shop rates, the pick and pay is a bit more fat to manage that cut than the shop rate cashier or the pick and pay shelf packer. So we think that between company tax, tax upon persons earning above 1.5 or 1 million, we mentioned specifically the inheritance and estate duty taxes, because again, we think there's a bit of space. Government put their threshold there quite high at 25, 30 million. That's a very fancy house if you have a house that big. I think any house above 10 million really is you're sorted if you have that kind of a house. And if your average house value in Khayelitsha, if you're lucky, is 200,000. If you're lucky, that's a former house, you know. So, we think this, but also, not just to show that we are some kind of mad communists, the UK has done significant work around estate duty and inheritance taxes to try to redistribute wealth, and I think a significant part of the British government's revenue collection comes from those taxes. We know it's difficult to do this thing in a very short space of time that government was operating in, and with a crisis in the economy in the state, and the president was literally had just come into office, etc. But I think going forward, we must have a bigger discussion on it. Judge Dennis Davis's Tax Commission has given quite a few proposals. But Chair, also, I feel that come next year, at this rate, we're going to have another VAT hike, because government is still in a crisis. Size is still a mess. The looting of the state is still part of the daily work of the state. And I think we're really squeezing the poor too much. And again, Chair, we're not sure why we must always kick workers and let them pay the bills. Because it's not workers who own Tegeta or who have collapsed SAA. It's, as Honourable Shopee says, Colin Andrews and all his successors. So we're not sure why the workers must now pay with blood. Chair, I think also on the McLaughlin in terms of the SOEs, we think that what's threatening is the very survival of the state. Government and the nation is ESCOM. We're not sure if government is being brutal enough about getting to the depth of the corruption there. Chair, it's amazing the kind of stories you read every day, and I think we must thank the media, the journalists there, who are also workers, for exposing this kind of corruption. That you have ESCOM gave McKinsey Company 1.5 billion rand for some nonsensical consultancy, that ESCOM is pleading corruption, so they want to retrench 3,000 workers. They want to retrench the 5,000 workers in your home province at coal mines. Chair, our last proposal around your ESCOM is that we should re-establish that war room that was in existence about 10 years ago. The government set it up, I think, for ESCOM and for even water affairs, the big crisis point. Include government, include business, include labour, civil society, but they come with kind of inclusive, long-term, sustainable paths. Because this thing of just firefighting is not going to work. Even this thing of SAA cutting your air routes, it's fine, you can cut if they're bleeding, but you're also cutting your possible revenue stream as well.
So it is a kind of inclusive approach to SA as well. And Chen, you know, it's bizarre that SA can lose money. You know, your Cape Town Joburg route is one of the 10 biggest routes in the world. So how is it we're losing money on it? All other airlines are making money on it. Or, you know, you fly every week. You know all those planes are full. Yet, this thing, we're not touching the real issues there. Chen, this is a wage bill from Oliver McLaughlin. Look, I think we must give credit to government that when the previous president took over in 2009, there was a significant increase in the number of posts for nurses, for teachers, for doctors, and I think even before that for the police. We only used to have about 80,000 police in 94. We now have about 197,000. So those are necessary good to deliver impacts. We don't think that nurses are getting paid excessive wages. What we've seen there, Chair, is really the explosion in senior management posts. I don't think we need to have so many DGs, DDGs, chief directors. You can have much less. Those are meant to be leaders, not an army. The fact that you've got 20,000 senior management posts, it speaks to the explosion, Chair. And if you check any Sunday paper, I can guarantee you this weekend's papers, it's SMS posts which will be advertised. Very few nurses, etc. So we think really an easy low-hanging fruit with a bit of work by government is around the ghost posts. It can't be that you see Northwest estimates of 80,000 ghost posts. Even if that's exaggerated by tenfold, let's say it's even 8,000, that's where we can go for it. Also municipalities, Chair. I think, Chair, look at this, Kosato, we're not relentless. You'll see within our wage demands for this year's public service negotiations have been fairly moderate. It's not been huge, huge. Chair, I think to Honourable Shoppe Sitole, we're glad that she remains captured by Kosato as the daughter of Kosato and Saktu. And we must also listen to her when she complains that we're not vocal enough. So that doesn't mean we doesn't also always cover all our 10,000 press statements. But, I think, we agree with each other. In fact, Chair, there's not a just ghost post. You'll hear reports in the Northern Cape of ghost T-shirts that there's going to be a Youth Day event. I'm the HOD. You're my sister-in-law. I'll give you the tender. We split the thing. I tell you to produce 10,000 T-shirts, but I know you're only going to produce 5,000 T-shirts. And it's systematic looting across almost every department. And if those of our members who are trying to blow the whistle, they are told, well, you must sign this thing, otherwise you lose the job. You know, that's even fun, colleagues choosing to leave the public service because they can't bear the emotional stress of wanting to be looped into corruption. I think I was still right about this thing of women nurses and so on. Unfortunately, the legacy of apartheid were African women, the only chance for a job was as a teacher or as a nurse. There's also a problem with Chair on community health workers who perform valuable work trying to reduce diseases, but they're not employed by the state. They're outsourced and given a small stipend. Chair, again, for us, we don't think we even needed to increase taxes this year. We just need to spend the money properly. There's no way we can say government is short of money. It's got enough money, but we don't see an effort to manage it properly. The fact that, Chair, that under Madiba's administration, we had 24 ministers, and I think about 14 deputy ministers. Today, we have about 35 ministers, 35 deputy ministers. And your cabinet is not meant to increase the population. You know, it's the explosion of the state at the top. I won't go too much into SA. I think Honourable Shoppe is correct. And in fact, you know, Chair, when we hired Coleman Andrews, we paid him about 200 million rand at that time of salaries. You know, that was about 15 years ago or something. So I agree with Shoppe's statement that all of that leadership SA is really what they've done almost treasonous. They put us into a crisis at this level. Chairman, I really should talk about the issue of the financial system in Treasury. It is quite shocking. We have many fights with Treasury, but I think, look, I want to frustrate the Treasury that they started good work with this chief procurement officer about 2 or 3 years ago. We've seen it seems to be kind of taking the foot off the pedal. We really want to see that CPO be expanded and to see the CPO's powers be extended across the state. So we want to see them being deployed to manage the procurement. Watch at least the procurement systems in the SOEs and the local government where the looting really is the name of the game. I think Chair, there was an article yesterday that Fernando was spending on IT systems. I think it's about 36 billion rand. And anyway, there must be cheaper ways we can reduce the costs. So obviously the CPI be given more energy around it. Chair, for anyone, Sarah Kwanwane, look, we don't engage around the headcount, but we think let's have the honest engagement of the Public Service Bargaining Council, not have government running away from engaging with us, constantly asking for postponement, recess, etc. And there's many examples. If you check in the budgets, you'll see the policy departments, the ones which are really exploding, like the presidency, GPME, your Stats SA, etc. I think the example of SAPS, I mean, it's a classic example. How can you have 56,000 people at a head office when they should be in the townships policing? And even though, Chen, you'll still be shocked to find that there are all the departed gaps of policing headcounts in white areas versus African areas. It's still a massive gap. And, of course, crime is predominant in the townships. Chair, in fact, we think that your departments, your cabinet, should be cut from about 35 to about 22. Not closing departments, but integrating them. So your economic cluster, DTI, EDD, small business, science and technology, should be one department. Agriculture, land affairs, it makes no sense why they were split. In fact, we shouldn't even have an SOE department. They should be reporting to the line function departments. There's a lot of space you can consolidate. And you do it over time so that you fill the vacancies, but then you avoid the retrenchment route. You avoid the collapse of the state finances. But again, Chair, you know, it's one thing to tell workers to tighten their belt, which is fine, but then we want to see politicians leading by example. So we hope when the president is correctly re-elected next year at elections, we'll see a cabinet of about 22 ministers. And I think we're going to see provincial cabinets of about 8 MECs. We could reduce the mayoral committees. We don't need a mass rally of politicians. You know, the fact that the cabinet can no longer meet at Tain Hays because there's no room big enough. I mean, it really shows you the bizarreness of the situation, Chair. We know that rent is up there, the financial crisis, but it's a symbolic gesture. And you have ministers who have exceeded the ministerial guidebook of 10 staff per minister, and they have 48 staff. And you find half of them are DDG level. You have a head of ministry, then you have a chief of staff. But we plead poverty and say, look, let's cut SAPs by 3,000. Let's cut correctional services by 800. So we think there's space there. And we're willing to sit at Treasury and let's go through this thing systematically and find each other. Chair, in terms of the debt trap in Africa, we raise this deliberately because if you look at what happened in Zambia and Zimbabwe, when they did good work of expenditure on education, health, and so on, but it wasn't sustainable, then the IMF then came in 1990 Zambia, and I think about, was it 15 years ago in Zimbabwe, and then really we saw what happened there. They lost sovereignty, it was brutal, and also, Chair, for a warning call to politicians, that is what caused UNIP to lose in elections in Zambia. And they never recovered since. I think, Chair, if even like a first world country like Greece can suffer this kind of a crisis, it shows that we must really work now before it's too late. Then, when it's too late, then we'll all be crying over nothing we can do. Chair, I think again to all of us, we kind of get a proposal of alternative taxes. And even, Chair, we offer that you can have a second VAT rate for luxury goods. You could say if you're buying a car worth more than 500,000, let it be a 25% VAT rate. Or for imports, let's increase the import tariffs, let's increase the duties. It's hard to work for Treasury and SARS, but let's do it. Because we know that the VAT hike is a shortcut, it's a simple, it's easy administratively for SARS, it's a guaranteed revenue generation. But again, we're just dumping the bill on the poor, and we're not squeezing those of the rich. Even, Chair, you'll see the discrepancies between what Stats SA tells us is the number of millionaires and what SARS tells us is the number of millionaires. So you see a lot of guys are very creative at how they dodge taxes. I think, Honourable Chair, for your questions. Look, we think in the wage bill, look, we agree, we can't have a wage bill which is 100% of the budget. It's not sustainable. We must get the right balance. We think that the increase over the past few years was a consequence of the additional nurses, teachers, SAPS officers, etc., which is a good thing. We disagree with government which says that the above inflation increases. Well, a treasury must negotiate for above inflation increases. others who are really doing our job. But I don't think they're reckless increases. They're not 20% increases. They're inflation plus 2%, inflation plus 1.5%. So they're not massive increases. And again, Chair, if you want to reduce the wage bill, well, we can start with the senior management posts. We've got a DJ earning about 1.8 million. You have a sales commissioner earning about 3.6 million. Your Transnet SAA CEOs earn about 8 million plus. So it might not dent the overall expenditure issues, but again, symbolically, if you want to tell Mercer to tighten the belt, then surely you can have a sales commissioner earning 1.8 as the other DGs earn. Ironically, Chair, the former president tried to do a good thing a couple of years ago and asked DGs to not accept an increase. They rebelled. They refused to accept that. Chair, I just want to check your other questions that you raised. Chair, I think the other issue is you raised the issue of partnership, and look, as Kosato, we're very much keen on that. That's all part of the Presidential Job Summit task team. We've been working closely with the industry and government on a variety of issues to save the economy. We're hopeful that the Presidential Summit will help push us forward. And I think, Chair, even our gestures at NEDLAC around labour market stability and on the minimum wage were the attempt at finding each other. Now, we've really, Chair, that when you increase the university funding, you had to find the money. We propose a variety of tax alternatives, which you thought you could do it, but also ways you can reduce the wasteful expenditure. And the key one is your SOEs, where really there is a lack of accountability on wasteful expenditure. But again, Chair, you know, again, symbolically, if every time we appoint a new deputy minister, one of the first things you see them doing is to buy a new car. And again, it's a small drop in the ocean, but again, symbolically, it's very difficult to tell voters to say, hey, tightening your belt. But for politicians, we can have cars with 1.2 million. But Chair, we want to see that power of ministers be removed completely. It be transferred to Treasury and to the government garage, and you just have standard, modest cars. Not a Beetle, but something modest. But Chair, again, look, I think there's so many horror stories you encounter daily. And since we've raised as COSATO, people have raised it in the media, it's raised by yourselves in Parliament, you don't see much done by government. You know, you saw last year the story that in South, they gave three persons from criminal syndicates tax write-offs about 1.5 billion rand. We have the Eskom McKinsey fee of about 1.5 billion. Just together, that's 3 billion rand. They think the VAT hike was about 23 billion rand. So there is space, Chair, we could have squeezed better. You know what happened with Tegeta at Eskom? It shows you, I mean, we're really chasing the wrong people here. Chair, I think we've spoken about SOEs as the nuclear bomb threatening the state. The other one which we're seeing increasingly is local government. I think you'll see the state vendor building society last week. There were about, I think, 15 municipalities are on the verge of collapse, including all of our shoppers' home province. And it's very willing, Chair. You saw a report this week in the NCOP that this municipality, which covers Harrismith, Maluti, Opofong, will not have money to pay workers' wages in June because of the extent of looting there, Chair. So that's another thing we need to really see intervention urgently. Look, Chair, I think on the issue of all of this, yeah, look, I really think you must get the balance right. You don't want to just spend fiscal dumping for the sake of it. But also, you must then see management being held accountable. Why did they budget for that money, they couldn't spend it? Because that money is a committed expenditure, but it's also a committed tax. We could have used it to avoid a VAT hike, even that culture in the public service, Chair. I think maybe the last also other 2 points, Chair. I think our release colleague, Guy Harris, made a point about paying government bills within 30 days, which is a correct one. But also we find municipalities on the virtual collapse because Department of Public Works is not paying its municipal rates on time. So this is an issue in Maluti Opofong, that they're having to chase government to pay another stream of government's bills. And the Department of Public Works hasn't got the money, Chair. Also, Chair, you will find a weird situation that provincial and national government, they do their supply chain quotes through this transversal electronic system. Local government does whatever it wants. They even get manual quotes. And it's obviously at the open cesspool for looting, Chair. really would want to see the chief procurement officer intervene in local government and have one system for the entire state. Then the very last question, Chair, was to Honourable Kobaz in the beginning about using money from automation and mechanization for workers. We would agree to 100%, but I think, Chair, we also want to see industry also playing its part of helping create jobs. So you've seen in the past 2 years, 72,000 mine workers' jobs been cut. Yet mining companies have huge amounts of money. And, Chair, I don't want to pick on a very, I think, progressive businessman, a patriotic businessman, Patrice Motsepe, who's a very good chap. He's done a lot of charity work. Excellent work. So he's a good chap. I think other businessmen must copy him. And we appreciate having Barcelona coming to F&B. But I think it's a difficult thing to change to spend 105 million rand on Barcelona coming when you've got mine workers being retrenched on a daily basis. We're not saying Barcelona mustn't come. But I think the time is, and I'm going to pick on myself because he's a good chap. But we must really spend the time, just kind of expect really are we spending money in the correct way. You know, as a chair, you still have an issue of this. The fact that Parliament spends about 4 million rand on the sauna, which is an hour-long speech, yet we are fighting in the Howe Parliament around performance bonuses. We think there is space in government for us to be a bit more introspective and tough and... Yeah, just lead by example, Chair. Sorry, I know I've taken very long of your time, but thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I met I think an incredibly diverse and interesting set of proposals, like the members of also find surprised at how much one agrees with, actually. But there were two particular things that I'd like to raise, if I may, Chairperson. One, in a way, a challenge. But I just want to point out something I mentioned to this committee earlier on. I'd like to mention it for the second time, just to bring again the committee's attention to it, because it links to some of the issues that Mr. Fox has raised. And that is, he has raised the issue of the reimbursement for community health workers. And let me also say in that category, early child development workers. There's about at least 100,000 of each of these categories. Now, Chairperson, with all the issues that are going about, being struggled around the public sector wage agreement and what the level of those salaries are, the current state of play on those categories is that the minimum wage as it stands, the total minimum wage, the 2,500 rand, does not apply to those categories. In terms of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, those workers are covered by 55% of the level, which is a level of, I think, probably around, say, maybe 1,600 rand a month or something. So it's well below the full minimum wage. So, you know, I think Mr. Fox and Kusato have put the emphasis here on, in a sense, saying that these workers are outsourced workers and should be brought into public sector salary scales. I don't think the Treasury shares the view that they should be brought into public sector salary scales, but I think we will want to register with this committee in a way our concern about the low level of stipends for these workers. They are extraordinarily low, and we need to find some kind of way of looking at that. Lastly, Chair, if I may just also make a slight challenge in a way to Mr. Fox. Yes, it sounds like 2 or 3 or 4% increase, may not be a lot every year. But if one puts the rand values to it, it ends up being 30 or 40 or 50 billion rand. And the difficulty is finding that 30 or 40 or 50 billion rand every single year. And I think the wording that the chair read out from the budget review, there is a very real trade-off between wage increases and levels of employment, particularly in the public service, but also elsewhere. So You know, I think it's clear that in sectors like health now, we are starting to reach a significant problem of lack of personnel. In a lot of the provinces, there are serious concerns of lack of personnel. But the continued growth in personnel expenditure is just really, really putting pressure on that. Now, in some of the other countries that you've referred to, and for example, in Ireland after the recession, because Ireland also went through a very big recession. There, the trade union movements in Ireland stood up and said, look, as part of trying to solve this problem, we are going to restrain worker wage demands because we don't want to see retrenchments of our colleagues through this recession. We want to see maximum hand-holding of jobs. And because of that, we're going to moderate wage demands. So, you know, I think that Cassata is not fully recognizing the rand value of the annual wage increases and how much it's mounting up year after year after year. You know, as said in the budget review, this is really putting pressure on many, many other areas.
I heard of this and I thought, yeah, this is something to look at, and your compromise position in nation building. When the economy is up and flourishing, we then increase to offset that time when we did not increase, right? I do want to hear your voice, Advocate. On page 5, would you like to just say something about bullet number 3? Page 5? Oh, you don't have a presentation? Okay, can you quickly run? Somebody run. Do you know anything about this or not yet? Still coming your way.
Publicly declare their taxes. So what they're doing is requiring someone when they get elected or appointed in that position to forfeit their right to confidentiality, which is guaranteed in their tax administration act. So this is quite a wide-ranging issue. What has been discussed in the Standing Committee on Finance was to have some and this might not be relevant. What has been discussed in the Standing Committee on Finance has been how to have oversight over certain areas of tax where we suspect there's something going on, something that's wrong. Can the committee get insight into the tax affair? And one of the examples was the senior official who was in charge of the clock. Now, Parliament, neither House of Parliament or the committee is empowered to go into those tax issues. So this statement of Cassata finds a little bit of a trend in that movement that we see within Parliament to say, is it right to have this absolute confidentiality on tax matters for everyone? The policy issue now is not to discuss further. As it stands at the moment, it's voluntary. So I can disclose my tax affairs. Whoever else, said they might want to be used as well to show what they're doing and so forth, but you cannot force someone at the moment. So it's quite a wide-ranging or intrusive measure into your personal space. So that's what I would say to them. Clearly, the support is in the finance committee, if you're looking at mandates of this committee.
So if you want, you can ignore
it.
Thanks, Chair. I'll just be quick. I think in terms of the colleagues and treasury, yes, we'd be happy to engage. We've also had a difficulty, Chair, with something similar to the community health workers with the expanded public works and community works programs, which we've seen basically become a way of balancing municipal budgets, that what used to be permanent municipal functions like cleaning of streets, paving of roads, is now in effect outsourced to the EPWP. Often it's the same formal workers. The difference now is that those workers are paid a very small wage as before. So, Chair, look, I think we're willing to engage with government, but government is also willing to engage with us. It might also mean, Chair, when we look at a sustainable approach to local government financing, we really need to consolidate some of the municipalities. I think right now our current 270 municipalities, with 90% of them in financial distress, shows that we need to do something quickly. But, Chair, we don't think it's fair that you can have community health workers, cleaners who are working full-time in effect, getting paid R11 an hour. Sometimes even less, Chair. We've had fights with different departments where at times they wanted to pay their public works workers through food parcels or below the ministerial set minimum wage. Chair, look, we're not oblivious to the need to manage the public service wage bill properly. But again, I think we want to see government leading by example, freezing the SMS posts. intervening on the state-owned enterprises where there is really a bloated management structure. You try to chair in terms of your spirit of solidarity or to say what can we contribute. So, for example, the current public sector wage negotiation, we've said the PIC can play a role assisting public servants with housing. So it's not just a drain to the state, but the PIC, which is in effect, well, through the GPF or workers' funds, can play a role towards it and help reduce the pressure on the state. But again, Chair, we don't want to see cuts on the top of the state. That will help to inspire confidence in your junior staff, etc. Chair, even in your spirit of, I don't know if you've renamed the new donor to Mamina, to Solidarity, we've been engaging extensively with government, and the Finance Committee colleagues helped us around the sugar tax that was introduced this year. We forced engagements with Treasury and business at NEDLAC to say, yes, the tax is coming. How can we use it to address government's correct health objectives? How can we use it to create jobs, etc.? In preparation for the job summit in the next few months, part of the proposals we're pushing is to see how can the PIC, the UAF, the CETAs, which have significant funds, be used in a sustainable and correct way to help create jobs or protect jobs as our kind of contribution to the table. And of course, if you solve unemployment, then you'll solve most of the nation's problems. I think lastly, Chair, in terms of the why we want to see your personal taxes, Chairperson, is that there's precedent internationally. I think in the U.S., if you want to become a presidential candidate, you must show your taxes. I think the fact that there's so much evasion of taxes currently, sources of revenue collections have plummeted, and the extent of state capture shows us there's a need for really for all of us to kind of share our taxes, especially at a leadership level. And you can include COSATU parliamentary coordinators if you want to share. I might be embarrassed by my lack of money, but it's fine. We can do that. And we think the people who are not corrupt shouldn't be afraid to share it. And then I think lastly, Chair, even on that, actually there's already a precedent locally for tax disclosure, because when you go through your vetting for the State Security Agency, you do disclose your taxes. So that's already a precedent there, Chair. And also public servants at a senior level are already doing that, though we think that you can extend that to ministers, etc., Chair. Lastly, Chair, I think as a good story to serve for Parliament, has been what Frank Jenkins was just talking about, the PIC Bill. It's really going to be a very powerful instrument to help address corruption and to minimize it in the PIC and to bring transparency. So, for example, the bill says the PIC must table its annual reports to Parliament. It must have representatives from trade unions sitting on it. It must disclose to the public its investments, etc. And given that the PIC is about 1.9 trillion rand, and given how everything these days is infected by corruption, we're hoping that will be a useful thing. And Chair, we're glad that the committee has drafted the bills in response to a COSATU call. So we made that call, Chair, on thinking of you and the spirit of solidarity, Chair. Thanks, Chair.
No, that's fine. Come up when we engage one another and decide where, on whether it is going to be the best solution to take the development of this country forward. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much for this robust engagement. Of course, you triggered it. But thanks. That's what we want. We want to be challenged, and also I see you also take a challenge from the members. You know, positively. That's what we call engagement. We're engaging each other. We're not fighting with each other. We're just engaging and triggering some thinking in a particular direction. Because all of us sitting here, we are leaders in our own right, and we're trying to find solutions for this country. We must find solutions for this country. All right. Thank you very much. I don't know if you want to sit, but we are done. Maybe it will be also of interest that you sit and listen to other presentations. Okay, thank you so much. I'm now going to call upon the CEO of CISA to lead us in the presentation, in CISA presentation. I want to believe that you're coming to Parliament for the first time. Welcome to Parliament. this is the parliament of the people, including you. So you're actually making it even more practical, you know, so that we don't end up talking about it, but you use parliament for the best interest of this country. All right. Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming.
If it's fine, I can set the events.
Please. We want you to be as comfortable as possible. That's why I said, please feel free. And then we will then take it from there. Honourable members, maybe I should give you just some 5 minutes, a human rights break. I know it has been a bit rough, just for us to take some breathing space and then come back. 5 minutes, human rights break. And you are aware of the tea at the back. Please feel free to serve yourself. It's yes, it's self-service. Oh, and this invitation is extended to all the guests. this is our tea. Okay, but I have to speak to you because you're about to get seriously involved. So to say, listen, if you don't mind, you can grab a cup of tea, sit down, and then you proceed with your presentation.
No. The breaker. Breaker.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, shall we now settle down so that we can proceed with the business of this meeting? All right, CEO, you can press on. And you can introduce your team. Also, you know, you don't know, we're very happy that you came.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and members of your Appropriations Committee. I'm hoping that you can hear me clearly. If I may...
shall we please listen to this presentation? Yes, sir?
if I may introduce my team to start with. I'm accompanied by my colleagues, the past presidents of CISA, Lynn Pretorius and Abe Chele. On my left here is the CEO of CISA, Consulting Engineers South Africa, and I'm the current sitting president of CISA. So you're quite right. It is our first time in Parliament, so thank you for your warm welcome and your words of making us feel comfortable. Our intention is we'll run very quickly through the presentation we've prepared. Let me just make sure that I'm speaking directly into the mic. I'll go through all of the key points that we believe require some deliberation. And if at all possible, I'll then bring in my team in the deliberation session on specific issues that hopefully will come up in the presentation.
Okay, so how much time? Because you've seen, members need more time to interrogate.
So I'll try and do the presentation very quickly and leave more time for the deliberation.
Yes,
there's only 13 slides, but I'm probably not going to spend as much time on each slide.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Talk to your presentation. Okay. Again. I love members, yeah. This presentation was circulated to members also. Yeah, okay.
So if I could very quickly introduce Consulting Engineers South Africa. We represent, we're a voluntary industry association, having been in existence for in excess of 65 years. Collectively, all four of us are professional engineers with in excess of 110 years collective experience in the engineering and infrastructure space. I think I'd like to make a few points with regards to the industry that we represent. First and foremost, there was a lot of discussion around consultants. We're consulting engineers, and I think there needs to be a complete disparity drawn between the two. A reference was made to the McKinsey's and the PwC's and the KPMG's, who in essence employ a lot of engineers, but those are not practicing engineers. Consulting engineers are in the business of doing technical work, and all of us are practicing technocrats. So there is a difference, and I'd like to highlight that. Second thing is that as consulting engineers, we are not contractors. We are the group of people that do all of the upfront planning, design, and preparation to be executed by construction companies and contractors. So I think those are a few important issues that we must put on the table. And then lastly, in looking at our membership base, we represent 560 member companies, all of which employ in excess of 24,000 technical professional staff. So that's the industry that you're talking to here today. And in doing what we try to do, we have a specific code of conduct really focused on ethical issues and really trying to shape our industry from a value perspective. And our code of conduct and our constitution has specific accreditation aspects that require companies to fulfill before they are admitted to Consulting Engineers South Africa. We, in listening to the President's address and in formulating our address for this year and our focus for this year, we really looked at our drive and an acknowledgement being that our future is now. In other words, we've really got to set the platform on a sustainable base for our future generations in this country if we're going to succeed. And in so doing, we picked on a few key themes for this year. One obviously being effective ethical leadership, transformation, in other words, embracing gender, youth, and digitization, working with our colleagues in the industry, and that includes government, because we believe in infrastructure, the ultimate objective is to deliver infrastructure successfully. So it's not about government, and it's not about private sector, and it's not about consultants or contractors. It's about the actual infrastructure projects. So it's collaboration, And then the last thing is about, I think there was a lot of discussion earlier about corruption. It's really about working with our clients to root out corruption as best as possible. With our focus being on leadership, we believe in the infrastructure space that leadership resides in National Treasury. And because this is the organization that all of the funding and allocation, all the way from procurement through to planning, execution, and assurance, is dealt with. And if we are to truly achieve value for money in terms of state expenditure, then it does have to sit with National Treasury. We believe the challenges that face our industry right now is a lack of technical skills in the public sector. I know a lot of discussion revolved earlier around the public spend. We are of the view that there's not enough money spent on technical practitioners in the business of infrastructure, in public, in the SOEs, in public departments, and at provincial level. We think that that needs to be addressed. We believe that the generic approach to procurement is an issue that I think has been partly addressed by Treasury, but the follow-through has not been seen. And right now we're seeing the feast and famine approach in the construction and infrastructure space, where you have a 2010 World Cup with a glut of work and then everything comes to a grinding halt. We often view that the construction and infrastructure space is a very clear indicator of the health of our economy, because it's a large employment creator, and it's a lever that we can use to generate as many jobs as possible. And lastly, we think that one of the issues is the lack of planning. In other words, we work on a budget cycle year on year, but don't necessarily, you know, we go from emergency to the next emergency without really investing in planning and creating a pipeline of projects that we may use unspent budgets for, or may create a sustainable basis for our industry to prosper and operate correctly. I think this is just a snapshot. You know, in the last 16-odd years, we've spent an enormous amount of money on infrastructure investment. And it's about really looking at, and we see the infrastructure investment declining. We understand the country is under pressure. We under no illusions to say continue spending. We believe, I think the first speaker articulated, how can we do more with less? We firmly of the view that we are able, this country has adequate skills and adequate professionals to be able to generate more jobs, more growth, and to do more in terms of the infrastructure space with less. And one such example, I refer you to work done by the National Planning Commission. And here I must commend National Treasury, because I think the work, our second speaker did raise the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer. There was sterling work done in the formulation of SIPTM. And I'm aware that this committee has listened to a presentation from the CIDB on SIPTM. We believe that that work has stalled. We believe that the execution of SIPTM has not been followed through. And in as much as we've partnered with Treasury and we've worked closely with Treasury, we believe that the actual skills in place in Treasury do not reside in the National Treasury to do the effective work that is needed. And here, it comes back to Treasury having a proper infrastructure team, but also various departments and client bodies that are reliant on Treasury funding, understanding their role as the client and what is required of them, especially. And please forgive me, I'm speaking specifically from infrastructure and infrastructure perspective. We do not believe that, you know, the role of the client is understood completely across all of our departments or implementation agents. And here we believe that it's not a case of client departments replacing workers with consultants. We don't believe that that's the answer. We believe that client departments need to have a set amount of in-house skills, specifically from a technical perspective that understand infrastructure. And you know, we can pick this up in further discussion. But I refer you to a slide on infrastructure, and this depicts a pie chart in terms of the overall life cycle costs of typical assets. On average, 2% of the asset's life cycle cost is accounted for by consulting engineering. In other words, the planning and the design element. Roughly about 30% is taken up by the construction or the capital costs, and about 68 to 70% is taken up in terms of the operations and maintenance of that asset over a 20 to 30 year period, depending on how long that asset is designed for. And we ask the question, and we continue asking the question, in as much as we understand the Constitution calling for procurement on a cost-effective, transparent, competitive basis, we ask the question, does lowest cost substitute for value for money in terms of state expenditure? And that's an area we believe that National Treasury can play a fundamental role in terms of looking at infrastructure. I think in 2015, Treasury made a bold step to separate procurement on infrastructure and general procurement. But again, we're not seeing that follow through happen across Treasury, state-owned enterprises, and other departments. The Infrastructure Delivery Management, or SIPDM, allows for various gauge reviews, allows for various areas within the project cycle for informed clients with the right technical skills to either accelerate delivery or to stop delivery. And we don't get to the end of a project, you know, and often we have a bad habit in the infrastructure space of getting to the end of large infrastructure projects and finding that we 2, 3, 4 times the original budget. And it's right for public to ask the questions, where was the planning? We believe any infrastructure projects have various stages that allows Treasury in particular and implementing agents to determine whether to go, to halt, to accelerate, or to decide on a different strategy. But that all revolves around the right skills being employed in government departments or in public sector to be able to make those decisions. And in terms of our proposals on a way forward, we believe skills and competent technical skills is the answer. We think, as the President has called for an economic advisory committee, an independent advisory committee, we believe the President needs an infrastructure, an independent infrastructure advisory committee. Outside of the SOEs, people that are unbiased and unashamed in their view on maximizing growth, maximizing employment, and looking at the good of the country. Most importantly, we believe that Treasury needs to have a particular infrastructure directorate capacitated with specific infrastructure professionals, and we think that this needs to follow through to the Auditor General's office as well, especially in the audit process. We believe that the audit functions and the Treasury functions become mere tick box and compliance elements, as opposed to really querying and interrogating value for money in terms of state spend. And then lastly, we believe that clients need to capacitate themselves correctly. So we're calling for a focus on value for money as opposed to lowest cost procurement in infrastructure. And we're calling for more quality-based selection criteria as opposed to mere cost. And then lastly, to really look at collaboration with the public, with the private sector, especially statutory bodies like ECSA, where we need to focus a lot more on engineering skills and bringing in competence as opposed to compliance. And as a throwaway, we at CISA, we welcomed this invite, and we avail ourselves to work with committees like yourself, but in particular with Treasury, to look at how we work with government to ensure that the correct spend and the correct focus to infrastructure is prepared. And as a last slide, we believe that to answer a lot of our questions, you know, maybe the development of some sort of Marshall Plan on either housing or energy or water, where government takes this not and relegates it to a recipient department or an implementing department, but keeps it centrally and really focuses on how we bring SMME development, growth, employment, integration, and deliver and work hard to solve issues that face us from an infrastructure point of view. I thank you for the time. I said I'll try and be as quick as possible, and I hope that with our deliberations, my team and I can answer your questions on the key issues that we've raised.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Honorable members, do you have clarity-seeking questions or comments on partnerships? You can see we have also formed partnership with National Treasure. Doctor, did you hear that?
Yes,
yeah, so I'm trying to say it does look like that's the way to go, working in collaboration with one another to do more, you know? Yeah, to do more with less. All right, Honorable Member Tobaza, Honorable Member Matlotsi, or Honorable Member Snukwanyani, in that order.
Just two questions, Chairperson. Let me start off with slide page 3, the graph slide. I see that there was a good rise in terms of construction infrastructure work, or is it prices that you are making reference to there? I thought I was reading, you know, the rise of infrastructure work coupled with the rise of employment from something like 260,000 to 320,000. If you could help me read that, because what I want to understand from there is then in 2017 there is a dip, and why that dip? Similarly, on the next one, the next slide, you see a negative around 2012, and then a sharp rise 2013, decline around 2014-15, and somewhere in 2015 a rise and a dip, a slight decline, and a very quick decline in 2016. Something shoots up in around 2016-17, and then a huge negative in 2017. If you could explain those fluctuations and why that was going on. I raised this question at the back of the infrastructure, government's infrastructure build program. One would have expected something slightly different, both in terms of the work itself and employment. The second and last question, when we met the CI DP or something, yeah, something like that, the construction industry group. And later I think we met with National Treasury. We learned that there is a very huge number of foreign construction companies coming into the country, obviously attracted by the infrastructure build program of government. To what extent are they, are such companies becoming a competition to the local ones? And the negative effects such as our South African construction company, which is very well developed, losing out. Secondly, the implications as well are that South African money could fly out of the country as a result. And therefore, what could we do? Our view as this committee, I'll put it very simply. And I think we are speaking for all parliament when we say we cannot allow South African construction industry to die because of foreign companies who would then take South African money out of the country. Of course, there is this little contradiction. We are calling for foreign direct investment, but in on the other side of our mouths, we are saying what I've just said. Now, our argument is we want foreign direct investment to locate in South Africa, build their industries here, employ our people, keep the money in South Africa, help us to grow the GDP. That's how we see it. But to come in, do business with government, finish, fly the money out of the country is a no. Killing of our construction industry is a no. So, South Africans first. Thanks.
Member McCurtin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and forgive me if I'm asking questions that were covered before I came back in. If you already answered them, just let me know and I'll hear from other people. You say in your first slide that you are not building contractors and you're not management consultants. Can you just explain to me where you fit into the chain and what value you add? Because it's just, the word consultant has rather a negative connotation to it in government parlance these days because we use too many consultants and it costs us too much money and all the rest of it. So obviously, I guess the concern is, are you here pleading for your jobs as consultants kind of thing? And I just want to hear from you how you would respond to that kind of issue. Then if I see you say here, one of the challenges is inadequate regulation in respect of professional registration of the Engineering Council. Could you unpack that for us a little bit more? What is going on? How could that be fixed? I don't mean just by a bunch of regulations, but what is actually the problem? And then just a very simple question, what does GFCF stand for? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and thank you very much for the presentation. Yeah, I also would like to speak to that first slide, where I think it's your profile slide. First, you say you are a voluntary industry association with just practice of existence. And I looked at the number of member companies. Actually, my question would be, where are these companies? Where are they from? Maybe my colleague has mentioned that are these South African companies. My reason for asking is that, you know, the challenge that I think we have in South Africa is that we don't have engineers in South Africa. We've got a dire shortage of engineers. And if we've got 560 companies and yet government is struggling to even to employ or to recruit engineers, government is struggling. They can't just get engineers. And if we've got so many, what exactly is the issue here? Is it because engineers prefer going going private? And then what sort of relationship then would you like to have with government? I know that you spoke of value for money, which I think I support, but where, I'm not quite clear what it is that what you mean by value for money in this particular instance, if you are in the private sector. I know the engineer thing is a very, very sore point for many of us in the country. And then on your proposals, you propose one of the things, the issue of competence, technical skills, and the first thing you said, an independent infrastructure advisory team to the presidency. Do you perhaps have a problem with the current presidential infrastructure coordinating team, because you've used the word independent here? Yeah. So if you can just provide clarity on that. Thank you.
I'm saying that coming from the presentation, the CEO states that it does not make sense to procure the smallest cost component on a lowest cost basis when you expect such professionals to provide solutions that save you money on the larger two cost components. So I would want you to elaborate on this one. When you come here, we also learn from you. All right. On the Marshall Plan, I want you to elaborate a bit on the Marshall Plan. Is it possible to develop Marshall Plan around housing, water, or energy? Marshall Plan just on infrastructure on the whole, from government infrastructure, one Marshall Plan. You'll explain. Yeah, that's why I say Marshall Plan. I know I've heard about Master Plan. Marshall Plan is comes as new, but it's okay. We're learning every day. So if you can elaborate on that one. And then all right. I think, I don't know whether this one is the same as Mr. McLaughlin's one, but if it's the same, it's okay. You'll then respond or can say so. Again, flowing from your presentation, you state that in cases where there is insufficient capacity, industry experts can be used to act on behalf of client to manage downstream appointed industry experts. I want you to elaborate on this, and if you can give also give practical approaches on how this can be done, and what are the best international examples of this. Now, why I was asking, I was trying to understand it, to say, are you talking to outsourcing? Okay. Yeah, no, educators on that one. Consulting? Talking on consulting? Mm-mm. That's something else. Okay, no, that's fine. With educators. Over to you.
If I may, I think I'm going to draw in my entire panel to answer specific things.
As long as they're short and to the point.
We short and to the point. I think maybe I'll let my CEO of CISA take the first question in terms of the graphical representation as well as the definitions, and we'll cover that in one go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification, GFCF means gross fixed capital formation. It's essentially the amount of money we spend in our capital investment programs. And how you understand the slide on the left, the the notion of prices is simply to make sure that you're comparing apples with apples. So the base is 2010. Because if you were to simply go on price, then it makes the comparative year on year, it skews it. The picture that is presented there is really to show you, in terms of those 2010 prices, over the years, how much expenditure has taken place, and how in 2017 we're down to about 297 billion. And these statistics really are based on the South African Revenue Board, on the 297 billion which was spent on construction infrastructure. So we do an annual survey, and our the company that does the survey uses the sources of information. What worries us is the downward trend and whether that downward trend is going to continue. The slide on the right is merely an indication to give you an illustration of the feast or famine. You can't go from such huge changes where you have a negative percentage and then you have a huge positive immediately after that, and then you right back into a negative. The challenge with that is if we try to develop sufficient capacity and skills in our country in engineering and create the jobs, those patterns force companies to displace those people. So, you know, unless we have some consistency in that, then may we be able to secure a constant level of employment and skills development. It's the biggest tragedy at the moment where young people go and study engineering and they can't find jobs.
So. If I could just elaborate in terms of, you asked the question, Honourable Member, that in terms of are the construction companies in South Africa, by virtue of, I'd also like to just clarify that this represents infrastructure investment. So it does two things. It's actually the capital cost in terms of physical construction, in other words, the labor and all of the construction companies physically building things, but it's also the investment in equipment, plant, and supplies that we see, you know, a large part of procurement spend in SOEs and those sorts of things, be it the locomotive tenders, be it all of those expenditure patterns. Now, we've seen over the last 5 years a growing trend to spend more money in terms of procuring goods, often from outside of our shores, with the hope and knowledge that that will come, you know, local plants will be created, employment will be generated, and so on. And I'm not so sure that that's been achieved. The current indicators by seeing local South African construction companies is a complete indication that construction activity in the country is down. The South African National Roads Agents have not issued a construction contract in the last year, and they're probably one of our better capacitated, technically skilled departments, and they've not issued a construction contract to contractors. And that's why you're seeing a drop in the activity in the 2017 year. So in terms of our foreign companies driving out or taking business from our local construction companies, I don't believe so. I just think that there's no construction opportunities. There are other issues in terms of payment cycles. There are issues of medium-sized construction companies going bust because they can't afford to manage the cash flow in terms of working for certain government departments, and some resolution around that payment and fostering ideas for how do we allow smaller and medium-sized companies to grow into large companies to become big employment generators is a consideration that needs to be taken. You're right, there is a fine balance in terms of foreign direct investment. You want foreign companies to come in, but you want them to base themselves in South Africa, train our local skills, impart knowledge from, you know, experience elsewhere, and to pass that on to South African youngsters. So we need to see more of those examples. There are some, but they're very few and far between. In terms, if I could just take the two questions in terms of what if CISA, are we here with our begging bowl asking for work? And the other question in terms of a voluntary association, and then I'll draw in my colleagues on the others, is consultants, you're right, are painted in a bad light, because at the moment, consultants come in, consult with departments, and leave very little value thereafter when they leave. We want to distinguish ourselves from that. The consulting engineer, in particular on infrastructure, are the design engineers. These are the teams of people that put in the planning in terms of, are projects feasible? In other words, technically feasible. Do they meet the demand and the objectives of the client? And if they do that, then can we then produce a set of reports, a set of drawings and designs to actually be the cornerstone of what that infrastructure build will be? So in other words, if I had to put it simply, we, the group of people that will design the road, will produce all of the plans and the technology that allows the contractor to physically build that road, or for that matter, this building. We will do all of the work in terms of preparing the necessary specification, the necessary designs, the necessary calculations for a building contractor to come and build this particular building. A voluntary association, no, we're not here begging for work. We all are volunteers, except our CEO, who is a paid employee of CISA. Our member companies employ, as I said, in excess of 24,000 professionals. We're a grouping that are really looking at the best interest of our industry. How do we maintain credibility and quality, and how do we make sure that we have a sustainable future? You're right, we desperately need engineers. But I can tell you that across our 560 companies, probably two-thirds, if not 80%, are in the process of downsizing and letting technically skilled people leave their doors because there's inadequate work for us to continue. Where are those engineers and why they're not working in government? We'd like to see them work in government. We believe that working in government, there needs to be a partnership. Government needs to have enough technically skilled people to be able to manage people like ourselves, and ensure that there's a dialogue and a healthy understanding about what government's needs are and what private sector can deliver. At the moment, the lack of skills in government make that dialogue a one-way dialogue, and we completely miss each other. So in setting government's objectives, you have non-technical people setting the objectives for technical outcomes, and that's where the problem lies. Now, can we get technical people to be employed by government? Absolutely. But they need to be given the platform to operate in a technical environment and not an environment that frustrates technical people. At the moment, that's what we're seeing. So I think I've covered all of that. I'm going to ask Lynn to talk to the lowest cost and value for money. And then, Abe, if you can talk to the industry experts and clients and the role of clients and how we proposing clients could work with government, or we could work with government.
Thank you. Thank you, Naresh. So the question was asked, what do we mean by making the statement that government is not really at the moment procuring value for money from the construction industry and from the consulting engineering profession. And I want to refer to that particular slide. I think that illustrates what we are talking about. What you are seeing there, that entire pie chart, that is the overall life cycle cost of infrastructure. The planning, the construction thereof, and thereafter the overall operations and maintenance thereof. Now, right now, through the supply chain management process, government is procuring consulting engineering services in a particular way, and we are competing for that red sliver. So the cost of that red sliver, the fees that government is paying to procure the services of consulting engineering firms, are squeezed and squeezed and squeezed, and we are finding that through that very competitive environment, consulting engineers are not necessarily providing the independent professional services required because of the very, very low fees that government wants to pay. Now, government is looking for a competitive see, it is looking for a competitive price. But by limiting that independent, knowledge-based advice, professional advice, by limiting it, insufficient attention is given to the programming and the planning of the construction work and the maintenance thereof. So by limiting that initial planning stage, you could end up paying a whole lot more for your construction phase as well as your operational phase and your maintenance phase. And that is what we are saying, that by only looking at a cost base, because this is what is happening right now with the procurement of consulting engineering services. It is a cost-based procurement primarily. The firm with the lowest fees are being appointed. And by doing that, you are not necessarily paying for advice that will enable you to use innovation to reduce your construction cost or your maintenance cost then in the future. So our question is that really value for money? Yes, you are squeezing 5, 10, 20% of a fee for a professional person. You are squeezing that fee, but in the end, are you paying 30, 40, 50% more, even double? You are paying more over the entire life cycle of the project.
Thank you, Niraj, and thank you, Chairperson. In order to have a successful infrastructure delivery, you need technical people, both in government and in the private sector. In the private sector, you will find them in the consulting engineering space as well as in the contractors. Over and above that, you also need a system to ensure that there are processes, planning processes, and infrastructure delivery processes that are followed correctly. And the system provides then the processes and procedures that are followed, and also allows decision making at the end of each and every stage in the process to deliver infrastructure. But then the question should be asked, as ma'am, you have rightfully posed the question, why are engineers not in government? Because you need engineers in government, and the system presupposes that there are skilled people in government to take those decisions. And at the moment, there are no or very less people who are skilled in engineering and who are technically skilled in other built environment professions like your quantity surveying, your architect, who are in government to be able then to take those decisions. So what we are proposing, this, I should state, is only an interim measure, because eventually there must be skilled people in government. Otherwise, if they are not, it will be the entire process will look like government is outsourcing services that they should be otherwise doing to the private sector. So what we are proposing with a system where our clients say it's a framework system, or what we'll call panels, creating panels of consulting engineers for departments that procure infrastructure services from the industry. And within the panels, you can then rotate professional services providers by employing some of them to capacitate government at for a specific project. And while they are performing that role, they are then not participating in the downstream infrastructure rollout, but they are merely providing support, making sure that decisions that are taken by technical staff correct decisions, and you rotate them so that they also participate in downstream infrastructure rollout. I think I'll stop there, Chair. Thanks.
If I may just conclude on that, we are experiencing a brain drain. A lot of our skilled, experienced engineers are finding opportunities working in places like Australia, the United States, the UK. And we're seeing that if you look at the profile of our industry, we're very worried that the age profile is going to leave us in such dire straits that our young engineers are going to be placed with the burden of having to learn their craft and do their work at the same time without necessarily having the right mentorship and skills to give them a leg up. I think the last thing I would like to ask Chris to address is the question on EXA and the issue around registration, because I think that is it might not necessarily or directly concern the Appropriations Committee, but it certainly has a downstream impact in terms of registered accredited professionals. So I'll let Chris take that one, please.
Thank you. I'll be brief, very brief.
Yeah.
I think the core issue here is, it's actually very simple. If you are ill and you go for an operation, you wouldn't go to somebody who's not registered as a doctor. If you want to stay out of jail, you won't go and see somebody who's not registered as a lawyer, professional. In South Africa, we have an anomaly. Our neighbors across the way beat us at it. To work in the space of engineering, you must, by law, be registered as a professional. We have a statutory body. It's called the Engineering Council of South Africa. And in pursuing the correction of the legislation, we believe it's counterintuitive that the Competition Commission should rule against them and see that as being creating some kind of barrier. But it's a profession. So, and the other thing that we need to be cognizant of as a public is not only are you wasting money, but you're putting the public health and safety at risk in huge quantities. People, through flooding, will end up drowning more. Buildings will collapse more, and so on and so on. And that is the ill that will be brought in through not enforcing such regulations. So I think that is the key message which I believe we need to think of in our skills, tightening up to get that value we're looking for.
Thank you very much. Indeed, today we've received very interesting presentations, and also just to meet yourself and to know what you are doing, and also to input on how best we can improve in terms of infrastructure development by appointing people with the qualifications, but also those people must be registered so that they are bound by the ethical conduct of this industry. So yeah, thanks. We are with National Treasury here. I'm sure National Treasury also would want to say something, and then we close.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll be very brief. Thank you very much for the presentations and inputs. I think the speakers were kind in a way because you know, there have been huge cuts to infrastructure in this budget across many sectors, which they could have pointed out with great detail. And that's a big problem in this budget. You know, the budget you're being asked to pass has got big cuts in infrastructure in many sectors, in housing, in quite a lot of sectors. And it's a bit of a problem that we continue to say that infrastructure is important to grow the economy, but we keep cutting infrastructure because we don't want to control wages, as in the previous discussion, and other things. You know, we say we believe that infrastructure leads to economic growth. We don't have economic growth, but then we don't invest in infrastructure. So, and this is not just the first year. This has now been happening for several years. And that's like, you know, showed for the last 3 years. So, you know, it's a substantial problem which we need to find our way around. We need a better solution to. So I think that's worth saying. I think the speakers have made certain specific comments about, in a sense, that certain processes have slowed down around the PDSM and the PUD and the procurement, infrastructure procurement, and I think those are important points. I think they shouldn't hesitate to maybe try and explain it and lay it out in a bit more detail in writing, maybe to the Minister of Finance, so that Treasury can put their mind to the detailed content of the areas that they see can be done better. If I can just say that, you know, although it's true that we've cut a lot of infrastructure spending, there's still a lot of inefficiency in infrastructure spending, a lot of wastage by departments in infrastructure. In fact, that's possibly one of the most wasteful areas. So much variation orders, so many other things happening. And one of the things I see, for example, some of the speakers describe themselves in the sense of the planners and not the constructors. Now, we have, for example, problems with some of the Department of Health, where they spend a lot of their health budget planning and they don't hardly build. So it's also a problem that some departments are doing, you know, they're only planning. They're planning and they're not building. So in a sense, they need to, as was said by the speaker, they need to, you know, look at the life structure costs. Rather take fewer projects and take them through from planning to building and finishing. But they keep planning and then putting them back on the shelf. And then 5 years later, they take them out again and they have to start the planning again. We appreciate the input and would really keep hoping to deepen this professional engagement, because this is a very, very important professional set of colleagues who have a lot to offer, and their comments about even inadequate skills within the Treasury in this area are not taken badly. Those are things that we need to strengthen.
I deliberately said he must close this discussion because he saw more relevant in that department. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming. And information will always be for good use. Right? Yes. So yeah, thanks. And then immediately I would like to call upon Bishop. Begwa, do you want to do a presentation or want us to consider your submission? Press your button, Bob. So we're now on item number 9. Are we all together? There's a very important item and it's something new. It needs our honorable members. I know I have to... The best is that you sit next to each other. Because when you speak, then, you know, I can hear you here, but also we get distracted. But thank you very much for your understanding. Now, there's a very important item, and this item we will be looking at for the first time, and I believe that whatever we do, we've got to do it right the first time around. So we will then request Advocate Jenkins to take us through this correspondence on item number 9. So it is for our learning, but also for us to do the right thing first time around. Thank you very much. Over to you, Advocate. Do you have the copy of the letter? Come again? Yes. 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 Okay. Yeah, it's the same issue, ne? I think your mic working? If it's not, please come. And I know I've been wanting you to sit here for a long time. Come and advocate. Thank you so much. Please come and teach us.
What has happened?
Wow.
Okay.
I sit here, ma'am, and there are journalists behind me.
Oh.
Not
sorry.
Today.
Yeah.
But other times.
Okay.
And then I see my screen sometimes on TV at night, and that I don't want that.
Remember, it's not about us. It's about the work.
No, but I'm also doing things which is of a private nature while I'm sitting in the committee because I've got a line.
Okay.
So I'd like to sit where the journalists cannot sit behind me.
Now I understand.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know, but now I know.
Yeah.
Okay, just before you start, I would like to say to the sister delegation, if you don't have any, if maybe you've got other work to do, you are free to leave. Yes. Thank you very much. Okay. So you may proceed.
Thank you, ma'am. The ATC itself, I think, followed on the letter that you received in which I wrote my memorandum to you. So we have a letter. I'll do it in chronological order. We received a letter on the 2nd of May indicating that the director of the PBO, Professor Jahed's term of office is expiring on 3 June of this year.
Okay.
And then the letter requests that in terms of Section 55A of the Moneybills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, you renew the appointment of Professor Jahed as director of the PBO for a further 5-year period. And then I then wrote a memorandum in which I indicate that in the Act itself, Section 15.5 is really the only provision that we have to guide our approach to appoint a director. There's no provision for a reappointment. So I would rather say whether it's reappointment or appointment, we must go through that process again. And that is a process, a parliamentary process, specifically a National Assembly process of a National Assembly Committee, in which we will require some form of public facilitation. And in my opinion, I say, I think the very least is just to publish the intention of the committee, as well as that of the finance, as well as the two committees in the NCOP on the website of Parliament to say we are engaging in this process. There's nothing in the Act to say we must call for nominations or anything, and the letter itself from the Speaker's office is to say to reappoint for a further 5-year period. So I think what I can then translate is the Speaker would like the four committees, the chairperson of the NCOP and the Speaker of the NA, is requesting the four committees to look at appointing the same candidate that they appointed before on materially the same conditions of employment as before as well. Now, the process on that matter is rather simple. The four committees must just consider this or consider the candidature of Professor Jayet. In the opinion that I wrote, I say certainly before the committee, we probably would want to see his CV, his curriculum vitae again. Maybe there are submissions that come from the public, so one can call for written submissions, if any. Committee can look at that and then deliberate. The committee is free to decide who to nominate or whether there's a different contract period which the committees consider to appoint him at. And I think it is more than fair to ask Professor Jahed if he has anything to say about the matter. He might have something to say about the conditions of employment. I've got no idea, man. So that's the process I set out in the memorandum that I wrote. I think procedurally the time is not on your side, man. They want a report, I think, by 28th of May, the House. So it means next week the four committees, either together, which will save time, or separately, must find a way to deal with this issue. So that I'm going to leave in the hands of my colleagues to organize whether they want to meet jointly or separately, or the NA committees meet and the NCOP committees meet and somehow confer through the chairpersons. Why I'm saying that is, although it's not impossible, it's certainly not envisaged in the Act that the NA or NCOP committees come up with different recommendations to the House. Whether it's in terms of, there's two things that you need to recommend. One is the candidate, the person for director. The other thing is the service of the conditions of service. And on both those points, I think the four committees must be concurring. I wanted to say at idem, but that's not the Latin, but they must be concurring to make it possible for the houses to pass those resolutions. I mean, if the houses pass different resolutions, you'll have an absurdity of what we call in legislation. Then we cannot give effect to that, so we'll have to redo the process. So there must be some kind of concurrence between the four committees. And that's just on a formal level. I think this issue needs to be just managed, and the meetings need to be set up as quick as possible so that we can get those reports to the House.
Okay.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right. Thank you. There you are. There's this extraordinary work that we have to do, and it falls within our mandate to appoint the director, am I right, of PBO. So we've just been informed on the process that has got to unfold. Either we sit as four committees and nominate the candidate and put the conditions that would want this candidate to, you know, to be employed under, and then the time frame, and then what then happens thereafter, and we recommend to the House. And I'm sure we have no, it's our mandate, so it's another activity that we've got to immediately give it our attention. And it's a matter that should be finalized by the 28th. And today is the 18th, so we have 10 days. When I say 10 days, let's subtract the weekend. Now, what I would like to know from you is who must facilitate these four committees, because obviously this is happening for the second time. So we would like to follow on the footsteps of the first time, whoever who facilitated for the appointment of the candidate in the first meeting, so that we then, that person leads us, because he's been there before us, and they will know this, they're familiar with this process. Do you have an idea?
No, ma'am. I would think that the board as it stands, as it's called at the moment, that is the four chairpersons and the two House chairpersons, one from the NA and one from the NCOP, dealing with committees, Mr. Frolick, Mr. Tal, facilitates it. But the programming itself is, of course, a programming committee issue, and you have a joint programming committee. I don't know when that is going to meet. If you want four committees, if it's just the NA, then the NA committee. But the programming committee is only going to meet on Thursday. That's my calculation. It must happen next week if we want to get to the 28th, the week after. So I would suggest that that these meetings, maybe between yourself and Mr. Karim and Mr. De Beer, just come to a decision when one can meet, and then ask permission. Maybe if I can say this, because I know the Finance Committee has got a very full schedule, so perhaps to have an hour or two in an afternoon somewhere, or a lunchtime, where the four committees can then meet. And I suggest that between yourself, Mr. De Beer, and Mr. Karim, to discuss it, to get permission from the houses to have this, because we are dealing with the budget votes, and then just to deal with it expediently. I think so, ma'am. There's a role for the whips of all parties as well, because I mean, things can get frustrated if people raise procedural concerns about certain things, and just to agree on a procedure, how it must be done,
And I would suggest that through the committee secretariat that notices as soon as a decision is taken what to do, how to proceed, to get it on the parliamentary website or to issue a press statement or something in the like which the media can pick up. I'm not suggesting we run a full-scale ad. I think that's too costly for this specific exercise. Also specifically because there's a parliamentary structure that advises parliament. So although everybody has an interest in it and would like to see it, it's really parliament and political parties that deal with this matter. Much like the appointment of the secretary, we can say, the houses appoint the secretary to parliament, by the way. So one can ask for extended public consultation on the matter, but parliament is the primary stakeholder in this matter. So I don't suggest we run an advert and run up those costs, but certainly publicize it and get it out in the public so people can know it. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. Well, now, what is expected from the committee? Because from what you are saying, the chairpersons, because I am a member of the board, but all chairpersons are members of the board. Yeah? But I want to believe that even if I'm a member of the board, it means I'm representing this committee, so I would need the mandate of the committee. Am I right? Yeah. To speak on behalf of the committee. So, which then means, presently there's a nomination of a candidate here, which is Professor M.I. Jahed. The nomination is about extension, because he's already in the position, but extension. The process talks to extension of his contract with another 5 years. So, do I have the... Yes, Honourable Member.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's clear from the letter that the chairperson of the NCRP and the speaker are both in favour of Professor Jihad, because that's what the letter says. So you already have two nominations there. If you agree, that's three. You can get a couple more, and I think we're just about home. But obviously, the committee still needs to meet to confirm it.
Which committee? This one? Or the other one of the chairpersons? But I want to go there with your... Yeah. Okay. Honourable Member Shopestole?
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I think I agree with what my colleague, I agree with you for the first time, is saying. But I also listen to the advocate. The advocate, that is why he's not a member of the committee. We wanted the advocate to be legally correct because he reads the law. He says in the law, there is no reappointment. And therefore, he advised that we can ask for a CV of the director so that it looks, you never know what happens in the future, you know, because I was reading here this CEO of you and helping, you know, people now talking about qualifications. When you know, so I thought the advocate is cautioning about such things, so that as a committee we must say we give you the mandate, but go and ask for that, because as a committee we did ask seek legal advice, because we cannot, as honourable members, be seen to have been negligent. Because I was listening in the bus today when I come in, they said the mayor should have taken caution, and I don't want to be in that space.
Okay, so the proposal is that we request for the CV, am I right, for our consideration, and then meaning that you will need another meeting to give me the mandate.
No.
I'm a bit dull on this one. Can somebody make me cleverer?
Yeah.
Okay. Honourable Member McLaughlin?
Ma'am, I would suggest firstly we should try and set up one meeting for all four committees.
Yes.
And at that meeting present the CV and find out, does everybody, do we have consensus? Because if that's the case, then it's fine and the job's done.
Okay.
And then we need to get it done quickly. So I suggest that would be the quickest procedure.
All right. So who do we report to about, okay, ma?
from ourselves, you have the mandate, and I think you can just, I don't think it's a complicated thing. Ask for the CV so that when you go to that big meeting, you say, we as appropriation, we have taken legal advice, and this is what the legal advisor said to us. He said, we must ask for a CV, and we did, because we have mandated you, and it will be available, so that there must not be no request for another meeting to ask for a CV. No.
I hear you. Are you happy with the manner in which we are dealing with the matter? Okay?
Yes, ma'am. I think you got your mandate. Yeah. I think to action that mandate, maybe the secretariat or through yourself can just contact both Mr. Follick and Mr. Tao and just suggest that you have the mandate to suggest that there's a joint meeting of the four committees to deal with this matter, and to request Professor Jayat to be there and to provide the CV before the meeting so that committee members can go through it. And I think then that's that. So maybe, someone just copy the other chairperson so that they can also get their mandate and proceed like that. Thank you.
All right. So after this, the secretariat will write to Mr. Frolic, informing Mr. Frolic about this meeting and the resolution of this meeting. The resolution. Me participating there and us getting the CV and consider the CV in our discussion. Are we together, Pelela? I told you about non-verbal communication. I see your head going. Now I'm trying to look at... are we together? Oh, okay. Oh, Kulma now. All right. No, I got confused. But no, that's fine. Thank you, then. You distracted me. Okay. No, that's fine. Thank you very much. I think you've assisted us well. This is exactly what we wanted. So we will then, I will then come back and give a feedback on the meeting about what transpired in the meeting. I think that's the way to go. Thank you so much. And please, may I request that we don't consider the minutes. We will consider them in the next meeting. And then otherwise, it then means that the meeting, we come to the end of our meeting and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.